So many of you have demanded that we have Sonia Poulton back on the podcast, and she has the fire. Definitely. She has so much resonated with people watching the videos. I've been putting clips out daily in December, and I think we started putting Sonia's stuff up over a month ago now, and we've got over 500,000 views on all of the stuff now. Really tremendous response. You asked if she would come back. We asked her, and she's kindly come down to the studio and giving more of her time. And we have so much to talk about because so much has happened. So thank you for coming back on, Sonia.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I just want to say thank you to all of your viewers. Amazing, amazing response. Literally amazing response. Fantastic emails, fantastic calls, fantastic messages. So much information that is enabling me to go down new paths, to build on information. I can't tell you how grateful I am to you, Sean. I think what you're doing is really amazing. I truly do. And I think that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You attract really amazing people. And, you know, so I'm really, really happy to be back, really.
And last time I'd interviewed you, I'd only watched your one documentary, right. Paedophiles in Prison.
Parliament. I wish.
Prison.
Wish.
Andrew should be in prison. Freudian slip. Getting accosted, let's say, by the Aryan Brotherhood. I won't go any more graphic than that. I'd only watched Paedophiles in Parliament. And since the last one, I'm going to urge everybody out there now to go over to Sonia's channel. If you're enjoying the content, please subscribe. She's up to 17,000 subscribers when I checked this morning. There is reams of content and multiple long-form documentaries. I've watched the Madeleine McCann stuff twice now. I've watched the cancer industry one. I was absolutely fascinated by that because I've written extensively in my War on Drugs books about the cannabis oil and cancer and people that I've written about who've cured themselves with that. There's one about Grenfell, and there's just reams over there. So in the description box below this video is all of Sonia's socials, her Twitter, her YouTube. All her work is over there. So please go over and check that out if you're enjoying these interviews. And the big thing since last time we had Sonia on was Prince Andrew going on the BBC, wow, followed by Virginia Roberts going on BBC Panorama. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on that and the Epstein situation to begin
with.
Well,
let's hit the ground running. I mean, first of all, the Panorama one was literally a hot mess, wasn't it? Let's be honest with you. I mean, you know, if you have to get to a point where you're talking about people sort of being untoward and all of this, when they are an actual child sex abuser.
Manner unbecoming.
Yes, manner unbecoming. Really extraordinary, extraordinary stuff. It backfired, obviously. It was his daughter who persuaded him to do that. I think it was Beatrice who was involved with some media. But Emily Maitlis is actually probably the BBC, and I don't like the BBC, I think we all have established that, but Emily Maitlis is a class act when it comes to interviews, right? She's always been really good at it. She literally wipes the floor with most interviewers. She's brilliant in terms of the BBC, and she was fantastic the way she did it. So that was really, really brilliant. But so obviously what we've had now is this big PR drive about how everybody at the royal family, you know, they're in agony, they're ostracizing Andrew, they're so angry with him and everything. All these headlines, you know, Charles is angry and is, you know, ostracizing him from the family and isolating him, and the Queen's angry. This is all rubbish. It is all rubbish. This week alone, I've talked to two editors on national newspapers about their stories, about these stories about Andrew. And both of them admitted to me that they were PR stories, that they weren't backed up. And actually, both of them said pretty similar things. When I said, why would you run with that then? They said, one, it had been fed by the palace, but two, it benefited them. Because when they want to be able to get the royal passes to go to certain places, they need not to have already upset the royals or the royal coterie. So they tend to go along with what the royals want, you know, in terms of headlines and things like that. And they're doing it now. It's an absolute rubbish that the Queen is angry with Andrew. He has always been recognised as her favourite son. He's got away with it for so long. You know, we know this. I mean, now we're starting to see how many business deals that he is involved with, right? We're starting to see the true nature of his relationship with Maxwell, which is a lot deeper than any of us ever thought it was. That is the reality.
Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. And I've seen a series of affidavits which will be made public, I think, quite shortly, from staff, Maxwell staff, who is not only talks about the things that we already know, like the 6-foot-tall nude portrait that Epstein had of Maxwell, all really odd stuff, talks about that kind of stuff, but it also talks about the relationship between Maxwell and Prince Andrew. And that is a long-term relationship. She has been involved in his day-to-day planning, involved in his diary, involved with his businesses. Their relationship is far more extensive than anybody has realized thus far. And this affidavit will blow it open.
I'm getting goosebumps.
Well, because it's exciting, because people are starting to, you see, there's an old expression that one of the suffragettes said, and that is courage calls to courage everywhere. And the moment that people start to speak out, it gives other people the courage to come forward and say their piece. Now, there is some people believe that at this moment in time, Maxwell is being protected by the FBI and is under some sort of safety and security. That is a nonsense. That is not true, according to my sources. In fact, she is still absolutely free ranging. Okay. Nobody that I've talked to knows where she is. Some people believe that she has returned to Buckingham Palace recently for talks. So it is much more extensive than we believe, you see. We've been told sort of like, you know, yeah, Andrew and Ghislaine, they were, you know, friends for, you know, they were friends, but it was only on and off. But we know that it was via Ghislaine that Andrew met Epstein. Epstein did everything for her. He adored her, according to my contact. Adored her. In fact, he would barely do anything without her say so. It got to that point that he became so dependent on her. It was a co-dependency. It was almost a marriage without being a marriage, and it had long ceased to be a sexual relationship. But what I understand from the person with the affidavit was that she was very much involved in a lot of the sexual stuff, certainly the procurement of trafficked young people. So I think that 2020 is going to be a big year for this, a massive year. So what I have definitely learned over the last few weeks is, one, the newspapers are deliberately writing fake headlines about Andrew being estranged from the royal family.
How does that benefit the royal family?
It benefits the royal family because it makes it look as though they're taking paedophilia or anybody associated with them seriously. And that is an absolute nonsense. The royal family have never taken paedophilia seriously. In fact, Andrew is just one of them by being mates with a paedophile, because that's what they've been doing for an awful long time.
You talked about Jimmy Savile last
Jimmy
time.
Jimmy Savile, Dickie Mountbatten, Prince Philip's uncle, you know, Bishop Ball, who was Prince Charles's mate and a renowned paedophile. Rolf Harris did the Queen's portrait. So these people have no problems being around abusers. Andrew is not being ostracized. Sorry if you can hear my tummy rumbling. I haven't had much breakfast. Andrew has not been ostracized at all. It is to make it look like the royal family are taking this most seriously and honour you, the citizens. No, you don't. You don't care.
Because Andrew showed absolutely no remorse whatsoever. He showed no sympathy for the victims. They obviously analyzed that and then said, all right, we've got to put out now that we're disciplining him,
yes,
to show that,
yes,
we take, yes, this seriously,
yes,
to get the public back in our favor.
Absolutely. The royal family always need the support of the public, always, and they get it unconditionally, generally. And still, I mean, the fact is if half of the things had happened with any other family that we know that's happened with the royal family, they would cease to exist as an entity. So the royal family are very cherished within the established England. That's the reality of it. And the British people, by and large, want to believe that the royal family are sort of pure creatures, right? We have this idea, you know, we know that we have this idea that anybody who's been through a sort of public school system, we automatically assume that they must be less of a criminal than somebody who's been to the local comp. We do that. That's in our culture. We've been raised to believe this notion. And so that's why they keep getting away with it. So no, Andrew has not been ostracized. He's not been alienated. He's very much in the bosom of the family. Tell you who gave away the clue was Fergie, because Fergie made very clear that not only does she not care about any victims, but that her only concern is for Andrew. And why? Because she's at the trough like all of them. And I'll tell you something else that one of the editors said to me is that the only thing they're upset about at this moment in time is that Beatrice won't get her big wedding like Eugenie did. That's the only thing that they're really concerned about at this moment in time. And some of the PR effort is to enable, you know, them to clear the way for that.
So you mentioned about the origin of Andrew's relationship with Ghislaine. What was Fergie's involvement?
You see, she's a very, very difficult character to work out exactly, because remember, we were told for many, many years that she was also ostracized from the royal family. And I think probably to a degree that she was, but not necessarily for the reasons that we were told. I mean, we told it was to do with the toe sucking and John Bryant and all of that. Remember, do you remember all that stuff?
Yeah, she was like older than Di, wasn't she? And Di was rebelling.
Yeah.
But Fergie, they had her more under control. She was saying that she needed to be friends with Andrew to maintain the family and, yes, and all this stuff.
Yes, yeah, it's just because she's at the trough. She's at the trough, as they all are. They're all at the trough. I mean, we know that. And in fact, if anybody watches about, you know, the Royals on Netflix, there's an awful lot of information on there. I know it's a sort of semi, you know, non-fiction account of what takes place. There's an awful lot of information that takes place there where you can see the foundation of the present day royal family and how much corruption has gone into that. You know, these people, their most important thing is maintaining the firm, and the firm is the royal family. I do really apologize about my stomach, which is groaning. But the most important thing is to maintain the firm, and that's what they're doing. So that is by any means necessary. Okay. And the other thing is in the documents that I've seen, which is really interesting, which I think is going to come out very shortly, and that is somebody is able to prove that Andrew was not at Pizza Express on that night when he said he was. And so somebody has submitted, which I've received a photocopy of it, somebody has submitted a document to the police to say that they can testify that he was not there on that night. And not only that, there are also further documents which shows quite clearly that Fergie talks about how Andrew was never one to look after the girls or be around the girls or take care of the girls. But suddenly you're Andrew, suddenly on that night, the big night in question, you're taking your daughter to a party at Pizza Express in Surrey. Come on now.
We went and filmed at Pizza Express in Woking, and we asked the staff, and the staff were all, no comment, call head office, we can't see anything. But we did notice that the sign on the door said that Pizza Express Woking closed at 10:30 p.m. and that Tramp Nightclub opens at 10:30 p.m. So to say that he was there because he couldn't have been at the other is just ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you, like me, have received phone calls from people who claim to have witnessed him at Tramp. You know, it's difficult to know how much truth is in it. You know, this is so much more investigation involved to even begin to get to the bottom of what these people are saying. But I do believe that there are witnesses out there who can, you know, bring the light to these lies that are taking place. I don't believe for one second that Prince Andrew did that interview with Emily Maitlis and told the truth. Not for a second. This whole, I mean, if you talk to anybody about liars, they come up with extraordinary details. And anybody who says, well, I don't sweat much, it's just really weird stuff. Whoever, and you know that you didn't sweat much all those years ago. It's really weird stuff.
But I'm cured now. So I can't prove that I don't sweat. How convenient.
Yeah. The biggest problem for Andrew and the royal family and is that it's public. It's not that he hangs with pedos or has hung out with pedos and became incredibly friendly with pedos or may potentially be involved with the trafficking of young people. It's the fact that it's exposed to the public gaze. That's the problem.
It's been around for years, but now it's just gone into the stratosphere, the public interest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that brings me hope. That brings me hope because honestly, five years ago, people didn't want to hear this stuff. They didn't really want to hear this stuff. People in alternative alternative way of thinking wanted to hear it, but not the general populace. They're a bit like, oh, that's all conspiracy theory stuff, I'm not interested. But suddenly, you know, people with blue ticks on Twitter are going, there might be some truth in this, you know. And I mean, I'm a blue tick on Twitter and so are you, but we're of alternative mindsets, you know. But people who are very conventional are waking up and going, ooh, that could be possible.
And a viewer has written in to ask me to ask you, his initials are RW, he said, do you think that because this is broached now into such a public arena, it is going to really expose what's going on and it will benefit the world, or it's all just going to die down and get covered up? Will people be permanently woken up from this, or will it just be brushed under the carpet at some point?
So difficult to answer, isn't it? So difficult to answer. I mean, when you think about the scandals that have happened that you would have hoped to have woken people up, whether that was Edward Heath being accused of a paedophile or anything, all the problems that have come out about the McCann situation, that didn't wake people up. It's very difficult to know. And I still maintain that British people are really, really scared about, not all British people, obviously this is not a banner statement about everybody, but I think by and large, most people want to live in their cozy bubbles and not want to think about members of the royal household abusing children, whether ritualistically or whichever way they do it. They just don't want to imagine it. And because most people aren't abusers, it is hard for them to step into the place of to be an abuser. And that's the problem. It's bridging that gap, because if you're not it, it's hard to imagine somebody being that cruel, that sadistic. So I don't have an answer for that, unfortunately. Let's just say I pray it wakes people up. But given what I've seen so far, I'm not as hopeful as I'd like to be about it.
Do you think it's a good thing that Andrew did that BBC interview and it's exposed it to the world?
Yes, I really think it was a good thing. Actually, I was quite shocked it was on the BBC, because obviously there's so many issues with the BBC. It wasn't on their main channel though, was it? I think it was on BBC Two. It was on BBC Two, I think they put it on, wasn't it?
I think I watched it on YouTube.
Right. So they didn't put it on their main channel, which is obviously BBC One. I think they put it on BBC Two, but nonetheless, I think that interview was the idea why he agreed to it, was I think he really thought that he'd be able to control the narrative, you see. And he's not bright, is he?
Supposedly he came out of the interview and bragged. I've cleaned that one up.
Yeah, now that wouldn't, because he's not bright. I mean, these people, let's be honest, some members of the royal household, right, for all their education, they are not the brightest blocks, are they? Let's be honest. You know, it's like, you know, the lights are on, but something's not quite.
So do you think he was used then, if he's that low IQ, by, you know, Maxwell's obviously a shark.
100%.
This lady can pilot submarines and helicopters. And
Yeah, she's smart.
And Epstein, he was, you know, street smart in a certain way. Mm. Do you think that they just used him to try and get stuff on him and to leverage their association with him in their other dealings with other people?
I think it's a combination of things. Don't forget, he's still a royal, and there's still credibility of hanging out with a royal, and Epstein would have used him in numerous ways, by royal association, and so would Maxwell. She's like the evil genius, let's be honest. She is, I think, she's pretty much the puppet master. I'm definitely getting a sense of that now. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, we have been conditioned and socialized into believing that, you know, women are always sort of secondary and not really capable of that kind of, do you know what I mean? We have, though, haven't we?
Yeah,
so we automatically, it's completely sexist. So we automatically assume that Andrew and Epstein are the sort of powerhouses and everything. And honestly, the impression I'm getting now, the stuff I'm hearing behind the scene, the impression I'm getting very much is she was running things. She's still running things. You know, she comes from a corrupt family, right? It's probably in her DNA, right? Robert Maxwell. You know, and so she was his favorite. She's been raised in a certain way. She's been raised in great privilege. She has incredible associations. I think that both her and Epstein saw the value of hitching their star to Andy's bandwagon. It was useful. It was useful, you know, literally by royal association. But I doubt they got much more out of him, because he's not even that wealthy. You see, the other thing that I've discovered this week is a sort of paper trail of how little money he actually has, which is why he's also blackmailable, you know, because he doesn't actually have a lot of money. And oftentimes these sort of less prominent royals, I mean, I know he's still a prominent royal, but like Charles is rolling in it, but Charles has
owns all the land.
All the of Cornwall stuff. Yeah, so he has all of that. He has all of the organic stuff, and so he has all that. But what has Andy really been doing? He's been playing golf. He's been running around on airplanes. He's been, you know, allegedly sleeping with, you know, young people, you know, young trafficked people. So we know that he's led a fairly unproductive life. But what I've now discovered is how many businesses he is associated with. He hasn't done a lot of work with them. He's been doing stuff at the palace. Do you know that he's been able to bring businesses into the palace, do work at the palace? They do this thing called, I think it's like, Is it Project at the Palace or something?
Pitch
like
at Palace.
Pitch at the Palace.
Yeah.
This is where he allows businesses to come into the palace, right? And they can, you know, he's literally using the royal household, just like Fergie did. Don't forget Fergie and all her Weight Watchers stuff and everything. They do this. These people aren't necessarily wealthy in their own right. So they use whatever they can from the royal household to get that money. This week, I've been able to trace that he's involved with at least 6 businesses that he's been making money from, right? I didn't even know he was involved with these businesses.
Are you able to say what those businesses are?
Not at this stage, but I will. But I will. I will. Once I've got it all down pat, I will. Because what I'm building is a picture of Prince Andrew not being the man that we thought he was. Right? So actually, I believe that we've been fed pretty much constant stream of lies about him. Also, the whole idea, if you remember, we were basically brainwashed from the 80s that he was Randy Andy. That was the way they portrayed him, right? And again, it's that whole Bill Clinton thing. If they can portray somebody as a womanizer, it automatically takes them away from being a child abuser, right? So I'm not making any bigger grand accusations here about Prince Andrew. What I'm saying is it was very, very convenient to portray him as a womanizer.
So I'm reading The Assassination of Robert Maxwell right now to try and get a deeper understanding.
Right.
Maxwell, he was hooked into the Russian mafia, Jewish mafia, intelligence services in the UK, Israel, America, Russia. The Russians were selling Russian Jews to Israel. And that's how he got, you know, in with all the heads of all of those states and the intelligence communities. So he was in deep. And Ghislaine inherited those connections. That's what I'm believing. And you've got the honey trap theory, that the Epstein thing was a honey trap, and that there's all these videos out there, the sex tapes. I've got a cop in Russia right now who's got some of the sex tapes. I had an author friend who went over and verified that. And the video clip that went the most viral out of all of the ones that we put out from the podcast, the original podcast, is who is protecting Ghislaine Maxwell now? Do you have any thoughts to add to how she's just a free person, how an international yes. warrant has not been arrested?
Yes, I do have thoughts. I think, again, it's her royal connections. I think that she's protected because in order for Andrew to remain as protected as he needs to be, she needs to be protected. And so that is the general impression I've got from the conversations that I've had this week and over the last few weeks, is that she is royally protected, quite literally. The people assume that the royal family are somehow these kind of like, you know, she, like the Queen is some harmless old lady with her handbag and everything and her blue rinse or whatever, you know, but this is an incredibly powerful household. And it's not even just the family at the core of it, but it's all of, you know, the people around it who enable the House of Windsor to function, per se. So they all have vested interests, and they have a vested interest in Andrew not going down. Because if Andrew goes down, that is problematic for the whole family. That is, I mean, Andrew is not going to be arrested, and Andrew is not going to be imprisoned. None of that will happen. It doesn't. I think even if we were able to prove certain things about him, I just cannot see that happening. The rules are above the law. It doesn't matter what anybody says. They are. They'll always find a way, right? In the same way as we've seen no imprisoned politicians, we won't see any imprisoned royals. But they cannot afford a return to what happened when Diana died, because that was the moment when it looked like, you know, the royal household was really going to tumble. That was problematic. When the Queen basically has to start appealing to the public, you know, and talk about the daughter-in-law she cannot stand, you know, as if, you know, in a way that the public want to receive it now. So I think that what's happening now is an echo of what happened then in 1997, and they don't want it to reoccur. And in fact, one of my contacts said that was the very reason why Andrew agreed to do the BBC interview. One, it wasn't only the BBC who wanted to do the interview with him, incidentally, all the major broadcasters wanted to do the interview, but he agreed to the BBC because his daughter had was a contact between him, and I think he felt that he was going to be safer there. He probably thought, well, the BBC keep protecting pedos, so what would stop them now? You know, whatever the reason that he agreed to do it, he agreed to do it. But I think they thought that was going to put that was going to put the lid on it. And in fact, what it did was it opened up a new can of worms, an entirely new can of worms. They got to be careful. They have to be careful. It could dent the royal household, but it won't bring them down completely.
You've said something interesting there. You said that the royals will never go to prison. That's a fact. So even though people have said he's the biggest idiot in the world doing that interview,
yeah,
he went into that interview knowing he'll never go to prison no matter what he says.
Bear in mind, if you're a royal child, you enter this world knowing that pretty much whatever you do, you will never be chastised or punished in the same way that everybody else in the population will. That's what, so they enter and they are imbibed with such privilege that they're untouchable. So he probably thought, well, I'll go and do that interview because this is going to be a breeze, just some hack from the BBC. You know, they are arrogant. We know they think, I mean, look what his father thinks about people, you know, so we know what they think about people in general. I think that he thought it was going to be a breeze. They'd put the cap on it and nothing more would happen. And in fact, he's made it much, much worse, but he's not going down. I doubt they'll even be able to get him up for a police interview. And that was the other thing. That was the other thing. Why was he being interviewed by the media rather than by the police? And the problem about that, there are problems about being interviewed by the media before you're interviewed by the police, as we have seen by people who have come forward and said that they were abused by politicians. When they were interviewed by the media first, it was a lot easier to rubbish their claims. Or, but not just that, there are also legal issues, because if you've said all this publicly, how are we then going to get you into a dock and say it? You can't, because then they'll then say this is all played out in the public sphere. It's not a fair hearing. There are many reasons why it made sense for him to do that interview, but it backfired.
So you mentioned earlier on about the Tramp nightclub witnesses that have come forward.
Yes.
I had a long telephone conversation with one and she gave me some details. She said that she saw Andrew and Virginia sat on a little kind of looked like an antique sofa. Or are there any details that the people that you've spoken to that you could provide?
Well, yes. And one of the things was, I don't know if Annabelle's has ever come onto your radar. Annabelle's is like Tramp, but it's probably more elitist in Mayfair. And one of my contacts, an actual former air hostess. She used to, she'd met many wealthy people traveling. And she said that she saw Andrew and Ghislaine at both Annabelle's and Tramp on different occasions together. And then another contact said that he had seen Andrew at Tramp on the night in question with Virginia. So it's difficult to know who's telling the truth, what. I'm still having ongoing conversations with these people. But I think it's interesting that Annabelle's has been brought into the equation now, because that's not in the public domain. So that's something else for us to start looking at. Okay, that was, again, a very elitist nightclub, you know, in, I think it's Belgravia, I can't remember, but it's the same thing as Tramp. You know, it is exactly the same thing, same kind of people who frequented it. And, you know, you've got to remember that these clubs, same as like the Groucho and everything, you know, when you step inside these clubs, there's a certain privilege attached to it. And there is a given that once you go inside, it's like whatever happens in Tramp stays in Tramp, right? Is that sort of, you know, and that was a given. So that's why it's taken so long for people to talk, because some of the people who weren't part of those inner circles, who weren't part of royalty or, you know, the establishment or whatever, they felt like they were special to be there in the first place, and they shouldn't be telling tales because that would reveal how sort of lower class they were. People get caught up in all manner of mind games, and it's taking time for it all to come out. But I'm in no doubt that Andrew lied throughout that interview. I'm in no doubt that Virginia is telling the truth. I am in no doubt that Ghislaine Maxwell is protected by the royal household now, because to protect her is to protect Andrew. They probably wouldn't protect her if he hadn't got himself in so deep. But I believe that that's where her protection is coming from right now.
So my contact who was in Tramp Nightclub said that Virginia was not the only person who'd been trafficked in there. And this contact,
right,
she had been trafficked. And she said there was an attitude among the elite. There was a lot more going on. And there was an attitude of people, it was like bring your slave night for a certain clique of people.
Absolutely. There's a video that surfaced online this week, and I'd been aware of these two people for a period of time. And actually, I would recommend anybody to find it. And it's a young woman called Aria. She comes from Richmond, and she talks about how when she was growing up, and the thing is, I know the area she's talking about, and everything she says is absolutely spot on about the area. I know it very well. I live quite close to it. And she talks about how Mick Jagger and all of these people used to live in Richmond and everything. And her father was extremely wealthy. And her father would take her to the big houses in Richmond when she was, I don't know, 7 or 8, where other children were. And the children would be raped. There'd be orgies. They would be tied up. And it was very much the bring your sort of slave to work was bringing your children, dropping them off, leaving them with these people who would highly abuse them. You know, and this was all taking place near a place called the Vineyard in Richmond. You can trace all these places, even the house she's talking about, you know, and that surfaced online this week. And as I say, I was aware of that story, and she's talking very much about, again, the elites trafficking and being paedophiles, and how they go about it and how they are all protected. Remember, you, when I was last with you, you talked about that film on Netflix.
Oh, I can't the twins.
What's the title of it? I can't remember it.
Oh, my goodness. I can't remember the title of it either.
I watched it because when I was talking to you about what Joan had said about Edward Heath and the hands and the children and the houses and everything, you said, oh, gosh, that's just like that film I saw last night. So I watched it. It really freaked me out. It was almost identical to it in many respects. They lived, you know, out in a really wonderful house, a manor, basically. The two boys weren't even allowed to sleep in the house. They were treated like, you know, chattel, like worthless. And it was a really, really strange setup. And some of these people, they're so detached from humanity. I don't know what's happened to them, whether it's because some of the people in the establishment have not been raised in the same way as us, for example, with like human contact. They've been sort of kicked out of the family home at a young age, and their emotions are frozen at that moment in time. And so they're detached from humanity, or whatever it is. But the stories that we are hearing about people who are in the British establishment, whether that's lords, ladies, whatever, they're grotesque. They're worse than we were imagining, really. And it is obviously difficult to find out what is and isn't true. But when you have two twins telling the stories of what they endured, I believe them. Everything they said had the ring of truth, and it was awful. And their mother actually looked like a man to me, and to several of your viewers who contacted me and said, are you sure that the mother is not a man, because it looks like a man? I thought, that is really interesting.
I was in tears by the end of that.
It was devastating.
I'll put the trailer video link in the description box below this video if you want to watch that. The twins were born into an extremely wealthy family in the Dorset area, I believe. So they had this stately old home.
Beautiful.
And multiple rooms, all this antique furniture, paintings. But the two twins, they were like dogs. They just kept them outside in like a shed, didn't they?
Yeah.
And then the mum, when they were kids, prepubescent kids, would just take them and drop them off at an elite paedophile's house and
photographers, film directors. I mean, just unbelievable people that she was associating with, you know, and there would have been something in it for her. Right. Something. And again, that's that currency we were talking about again. So whatever it was that was her kick, she would have had that supported and furnished by supplying her children to other people.
The kids became her currency.
Yeah, it was awful. It was awful. And then last night I started to watch Little Gregory on Netflix. I watched the first two parts of that. That was incredible. Anybody's not familiar with that. That's a story from France, of course, where the little 3-year-old, 4-year-old boy, the mother and father had managed to move a little bit further out of the village, got a little bit of money. The father was known as boss in the local factory. And somebody within their inner circle had kidnapped their child, bound their child up in what appeared to be a ritualistic way, and then threw him in the local river. And there was a belief that the mother may be involved. They were contacted, weren't they, 3 years prior to that by somebody they called the Crow or the Raven.
The Raven.
Yeah. Well, they call it the Raven on Netflix, but actually when you look at the story, they call him the Crow.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. Translation.
Yeah, but it's all again the same thing. It's this ritualistic abuse of children, isn't it? It's all again the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. With the twins, one of the twins had an accident, so he completely lost all of his memory of the abuse.
Yeah, that was
the other twin who remembered it. He got to a certain age whereby he said, "I'm not doing this anymore," and it stopped. Years later, when the parents finally die, they're going through the belongings, and the brothers, they find a naked picture of them with their heads cut off.
It's really weird.
And the one twin who's got the memory loss, because the other twin has told him that they had a perfectly happy childhood, he just looks at his brother and he knows, doesn't he? He's like, yeah. Didn't he say, did mum abuse us or did we get abused?
Yeah.
And it all, because the other twin who remembered the abuse, he'd reconstructed this world where they hadn't been abused.
Yeah.
And he'd imbibed that. And that was his belief to hide his own pain.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
But once that photo came out, his bubble burst, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then their lives completely changed. And I won't spoil what happens next and what they go through in the rest of the series, the documentary. But I urge people who are interested in this field to watch that and to watch Who Killed Little Gregory as well, because the twists and turns in Who Killed Little Gregory, almost like Making a Murderer, the twists and turns, so mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And it ties in to our subject, one of the main subjects that we were going to go over today, because now I've watched your Madeleine McCann stuff twice.
Okay.
Is Madeleine McCann. We did do a clip on it last time.
Sure.
But to set the table for the viewers, because like in America, what's her name? JonBenet Ramsey, was it?
Oh, yeah.
That's the big one in America. So a lot of Americans probably aren't familiar with Madeleine McCann.
Yeah, oh, they are now, I should imagine. Because Madeleine is the world's most famous missing child.
In this country?
No, she is the world's most famous missing child.
Is she by now? Okay.
She is, definitely. Right. Most definitely. But there are a lot of parallels between the JonBenet Ramsey story.
Yeah.
Huge amount.
But could you just explain what happened, though, before, to people who don't know?
To who?
Some people won't know what happened.
To Madeleine or
JonBenet? To Madeleine, yeah, to Madeleine.
Well,
yeah,
Madeleine was reported missing on May the 3rd, 2007, and this was when her parents and their doctor mates were all said to be at the local tapas bar. They were in Pradaluz, a small village in Portugal. They'd gone for a week's holiday. There were 9 adults, 6 of whom were doctors, including Madeleine's parents were both doctors. Madeleine was apparently left in their apartment 5A with Sean and Amelie, her younger twins, siblings. 3 of them together had a collective age of under 7. All the other doctors left their children as well, all toddlers. They went out together on the Saturday night when they arrived. And after that, they then were reported to have left their children every night while they went to the local tapas bar. So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Thursday was when Madeline was reported missing. And I always say, as I said last time, I always say when Madeline was reported missing, because we don't actually know that Madeline really disappeared on that day. So I always say it was when she was reported missing. Kate and Jerry McCann have always made a big deal about how they called the police straight away. Well, the first logged call was 40 minutes after Kate had gone to the tapas bar saying, whatever, somebody's taken her. There's so many different reports about what she actually said. They've taken her, somebody's taken her, whatever. There's so many different reports. But what people have to understand is that the cadaver dogs, well, the enhanced victim recovery dogs that were taken in belonged to Martin Grime from, I believe he's from North Yorkshire Police. These were sterling dogs that were taken in 3 months after Madeline went missing. The dogs went through all the apartments of the holiday friends, as well as the McCanns. They went through the McCanns' new apartment that they'd moved into while apartment 5A became a crime scene. And the dogs only alerted in the apartment where Madeline was reported missing, in the bush outside where I suspect part of her clothing probably got snagged, or where somebody may have hidden her when people were walking past the gate, because it was roughly 9 o'clock in the evening. Between 9 and 10. But these dogs alerted, and these dogs have a 100% track record. And so suddenly these dogs were right every time, except when it came to Madeline McCann, right?
So if they're alerted, the dogs, yeah. What exactly does that mean?
Well, the two dogs serve two different functions. One function is to find cadaver, which is obviously the scent of death. And the other is to find blood. And they did both. I think it was 11 blood spats behind the sofa, as well as cadaver. They, you know, the police looked into it. Nobody had died in that apartment previously. Bit quirky. The apartment actually belonged to somebody called McCann. It was who wasn't related to the McCanns. But it's another part of the story that makes you go, ooh, that's a bit odd. And so these incredible dogs, they weren't run-of-the-mill dogs. It wasn't My Little Westie going out sniffing, right? These were high-functioning dogs, and they were dismissed, essentially dismissed. And there were problems with the samples, and it said that 15 out of... obviously, in our DNA, we have a thing called, I think the pronunciation is ALIA, and it's the DNA markers. And the samples they found, I believe it was 15 out of 21 related to Madeline's DNA. And that
so samples of what?
Of the blood that they found.
So blood samples were found?
They found blood. The dogs alerted to cadaver. And there was stuff down in the tiling, you know, the tiling on the floor. I mean, theories are that they had given the children something to make them sleep while they were out, because Madeline had certainly woken the night before, and she'd asked her parents that morning at breakfast, why didn't you come, when I can't remember who was crying, Sean or Amelie, but they were crying repeatedly. And two nights before, the person above, who's now dead, the lady above, she recalled Madeline crying. I think she said it was like for an hour and a quarter. So that already made you go, well, they weren't coming back every 15 minutes like they said they were coming back anyway. But she also did say at one stage that she thought there were adults in there as well, and she'd heard adults. There was a lot of confusion about what took place. And there's obviously been lots of theories. One thing that keeps emerging that has absolutely no credibility whatsoever to people who have researched this is any involvement with the Podestas. There is this idea that the Podestas were in Pradaloos at that time. They were involved. There was, you know, you remember the Podesta emails that all came out and everything. People read into it. There was stuff to do with them and McCanns. There is absolutely no involvement whatsoever.
And who were the Podestas?
Podestas were the people who were involved with Hillary Clinton, who were also involved in the whole Podestas. Pizzagate
those
thing.
Podestas. So that's just been linked as a bizarre conspiracy
and
theory.
This is where it all goes wrong, because people want to take bigger leaps than they need to. We need to focus on what happened within that very small environment. We know there were some very unusual people staying at the Ocean Club that week. Very unusual. You know, as I've said before, Ocean Club, I've been there, you know, I've been into the scene of crime twice now. I've stayed there for days, you know, in the vicinity. I know it fairly well. And it's really like going to a Margate or a little, it's not a particularly affluent resort. It's not really somewhere where you would imagine people like BBC producers, bankers, financiers who were all there that week, all going to the little old ocean club. So one of the theories is it was swingers or meeting up, you know, like for their international jollies or whatever, which is possible. I don't know. That's a possibility. And the other thing, of course, is what I talked to you about before, which was other people's theory about it having paedophile associations with it, because the Gasper doctors had shown up after Madeleine had gone missing in May. The Gaspers had been on holiday with the McCanns and their friends 2 years before. And the Gaspers said that they believed they had witnessed, certainly the mother, Katerina Gasper, says she had witnessed. She had sat in between Jerry McCann and Dr. David Payne, who was on both holidays. And she believed they were talking about Madeleine. And they talked about how Madeleine had enjoyed this. And he circled his nipple, put his finger in and outside of his mouth. That happened twice. So that's a paedophile link. There's also a woman called Yvonne, I can't remember her surname, Yvonne Walker, Yvonne. She's a former social worker. She showed up the following day that Madeleine was reported missing on the Thursday night. She showed up on the Friday morning because even though she's British, she lived in Portugal. She showed up to try and help. She said, and it's in her statement, that she recognised Dr. David Payne from somewhere else and she wasn't sure where. And there's a big question mark over Dr. David Payne in terms of Madeleine McCann. If anybody wants to do a routine Google search about Dr. David Payne, they will see there are big question marks. David Payne was the last person reported to have seen Madeleine at 6:30 at night on the Thursday night. He described her in terms that I, as a mother, woman, human, was uncomfortable with. He described Madeleine as being sort of angelic and not really human and all this kind of really weird stuff that a father says about somebody else's child, right? So it was really weird stuff. So there's a lot of weird people around the McCanns, and the McCanns themselves are weird. So it's difficult to know what's happened. We know we're up to about, they say it's 12 million, but it's certainly in excess of 14 million in terms of the British investigation, Operation Grange. Kate and Jerry have just released their annual Christmas message. They claim that they've been keeping presents for Madeleine in the bedroom ever since she went missing. I don't believe it for a second. I'd love to take a look inside that bedroom. And I just don't believe Kate and Jerry's version of events, and never have, not the way they've told it. And I would happily say that in a court of law.
Yeah, from watching your stuff and other stuff, it is all highly suspicious. I can't figure out what's happened, but I do have more questions for you to try and get more information. Okay. So my opinion is that when you look at the McCanns and you look at their faces and they're not really the kind of people who have got emit warm energy and a warm vibration.
Sure.
So, have you ever been in shock?
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't sleep for days?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I've been in shock as well.
Right.
So, combine their faces, their natural demeanor with shock.
Yeah.
And I think that explains a lot of the behavior that people have criticized as being unemotional, and you wouldn't say that kind of thing. I think depending upon your psychological makeup, you would react differently to shock. Yeah. So you can't judge one person's reaction in shock to how another person would react in shock.
True.
So what's your response to that?
First of all, I'm 100% sure that Jerry McCann is a narcissist. I don't believe that he functions in the same way as regular people in many respects, because he's barely aged since the event. He's carried on. He's gone on to have a sterling career. Obviously, he's a heart surgeon. And, you know, it's all worked out very, very nicely for him indeed. Kate McCann is a highly emotional woman. In fact, I have pictures on file of her just the day after Madeleine was reported missing, and she has bruises all down here. Now, some people believe that was when she was being held to stop going insane, but she said she went out and she sort of pummeled the, not landing, but, you know, outside their holiday apartment, and she was pummeling that. No, she's highly emotional.
But it's a different way of expressing, isn't it, than facially?
Yes, but you see, my problem is about their initial reactions to everything, which I don't believe were shock. You see, I immediately have a problem with a mother who's not going out and combing the streets for their missing child. I immediately have a problem with that. I can't imagine any kind of shock would render you immobile in such a situation, right? So I already have a problem with that. There's problematic. And they say she went out in the early hours of the morning and people weren't around and everything. And so they found, as soon as people started to criticize that, they then found a way around it. And they've always had an answer to any criticism rather than just go, we were parents in trauma. They've always had an answer to the criticism, right? There's always been something to come back about. She didn't cooperate with the Portuguese police. They brought in public relations and people who would, you know, manage their image. This is all highly unusual stuff for parents of kidnapped children. And so I completely agree with you about shock, but I don't believe that's why they responded necessarily the way they did. I think they responded the way they did because they knew what had happened to Madeline and there was nothing more that could be done.
Was there a point where they were cooperating with the police and then they stopped?
Yes.
Okay, because some people are naive to police methods. And, you know, I was schooled from the very beginning never to cooperate with the police. I was a criminal. Obviously, I'm not a victim. My kid's got lost. It's a different situation. But it can apply if the police turn the suspicions on you, as we saw with Brendan Dassey and Making a Murderer. So I was taught, you know, as soon as you get arrested, right to remain silent, speak to my lawyer, which is what I did. But I've met people in jail who thought they were helping the police in situations. And I've known of stories of people who didn't think that they were suspects in things and are serving life sentences now because they did talk to the police. So lawyers, to cover that base, once lawyers get involved, they'll say, look, don't answer this question. Say no comment.
And
don't talk to the
happened.
Police.
And the lawyers did tell her not to. But there's no lawyer in this world. I literally cannot imagine a situation where I'm trying to find my child and I'm not prepared to cooperate with the people who were trying to help me find her, right? So I can't imagine that situation. But it's not just that, Sean. I get that. If it was that alone, I get that because I know how that... They were made arguido, which is a person of interest in Portugal. And that's how their legal system works. But already the McCanns were breaking the law from the get-go. Even the fact that they had Justin McGuinness, their first PR person, right, who was there as like a campaign manager. She was already feeding out information, as I show in one of the documentaries, to BBC reporters, right? So they were already breaking the law. Kate was inside when they were made arguido, sending text messages to the outside world about what was going on. They were breaking the law constantly, right? So it was like they were going up yours constantly to the Portuguese police. But it wasn't just her not being prepared to cooperate with the police that I had a problem with, because from that perspective, I understand what you're saying. And certainly because they've been made arguido, it could have been problematic for them. It was everything else. They did everything they could to avoid a reconstitution, a reconstruction, right? But then they went and did one for a Channel 4 programme with the police that they brought in and financed themselves, you know, all stuff like that, right? So they were constantly trying to inform the public of their narrative, how they wanted their narrative to be, while doing everything they could to undermine the actual police investigation, because they knew that the Portuguese police believed they were involved.
So in Who Killed Little Gregory, there is a murder suspect, and that, I don't know how far into it you've got. I don't want to spoil the plot, but I've got to say this because I want to ask you further questions.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Well, that person, something happened to that person. So then they've got no one to get then. So the police do arrest the mum.
Yeah.
And put her in prison.
Yeah.
And I just saw a lot of parallels between that and the McCann case. The mum was eventually exonerated and released, but it was just so traumatic. And the dad, what he goes through as well, I won't spoil that, but it really just broke my heart for that family. Now, with the McCann case, though, I'm still highly suspicious of their involvement and what could potentially have happened, because it's such a mystery. I think it was more clear-cut in Who Killed Little Gregory that the parents were innocent than it is in the McCann case.
Yeah.
So... If I had a kid and my kid got snatched, for example, and I was overseas, when I was part of the underworld, high up in the underworld in Arizona, say a crime had happened in the underworld, nothing to do with child trafficking, but drug crimes we were involved in, we would know about like people getting their houses, say some criminals had robbed some other criminals of drugs. You know, we would know all the parties involved. Sometimes we would mediate that kind of thing. So, and things that happened that were above my head, I would go to people higher in the criminal in the world than me to find out what had actually happened and see if that could be solved.
Right.
Now, the biggest mafia in the world is the political mafia.
Right.
They had political connections, the McCanns. And they utilized those connections in the same way I would have utilized my connections. I would have gone above myself. They went to the highest levels of politics, didn't they?
Yes.
The politicians then, because they're such big criminals, they used that then for their own purposes. And this whole industry was established around it.
Yeah.
Now, Shannon Matthews, her mum did not have those connections.
Working class.
And the newspaper offered, what, 50,000 reward for Shannon?
Yeah.
And it was 1.5 million for Madeleine McCann. But my point is here, people have criticised that they utilised these connections and it was unfair. But if my kid's gone, I would do everything possible. I would utilize every connection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've never criticized that. I get that. I would have done the same thing as well. But it's, we're not dealing with the same, you know, we're not all starting from a fair point. That is the reality. Jerry McCann had already had some involvement with government to do with the Comair, or I can't remember. I think it's to do with that. But Gordon Brown's brother was also on the same board. Gordon Brown was a month away from being prime minister when Madeleine went missing. He was very much seen as a money's man, really quite cold. And also, it was interesting that, if I remember correctly, Gordon Brown's, this was odd. You might remind me if you've watched it. Gordon Brown's brother lived in the street of the very first woman, Jill, who was an old medical friend of the McCanns. And she bumped into Gordon Brown's brother and said, do you think Gordon could do something? Right. And then Jill went on air on what was then GMTV and announced, that was the very first news announcement on May the 4th, 2007, that a little girl had gone missing in Portugal. And that woman had said to Gordon Brown's brother, happened to coincidentally live in the same street. So all of that stuff's quite peculiar as well. But there was so much more that makes it unfair. Shannon Matthews, from the outset, we believed that Shannon Matthews had obviously been kidnapped. But Shannon Matthews probably looked a bit like me when I was a kid. You know, she had all bits knocked out of her. She was falling apart. Her hair was, the fringe was cut like this. And she was a bit of a mess, really. You know, she was clearly, there was neglect taking place and all manner of things. And the British public took one look at her. It's terrible. It's a reality. And found her worth less than Madeleine. Heaven forbid if she was a little black kid, what would have happened then? Would she have been worth 100,000, right? Do you know what I mean? What would she have been worth? So we know all that's taken place. Well, so that's about problems within our society, how we've been raised to see people in a certain way, how we give too much credence to people higher up in the hierarchy. We assume they're more clever and more pure than they really are. All of these things, it's all stuff we've got to break down. And I think this is a challenge for us in 2020, right? Is to start to see beyond the initial front. So we've got to start doing that anyway. But, you know, there was so much involved in the McCann story. There's no way that the story is as we've been told. No way at all. 100%. I say this repeatedly, and I have never accused Kate and Jerry of anything other than saying I would be prepared to stand in a court of law and challenge their version of events. I would be prepared to do that because I believe it is full of holes. That's been proven anyway. I mean, there are so many problems with it. They couldn't remember whether they came in through the sliding door or the front door. They, you know, couldn't remember what time they came. They couldn't remember who did that. I mean, there's so many problems. Even just the next day when they're giving, you know, details and statements that they couldn't remember, You know, your child's gone missing. You should be able to remember some stuff, basic stuff. So it was problems right from the beginning. And I think it is one of the greatest cover-ups that we are experiencing in our lifetime. I do.
Yeah, so what I did, I watched your docs, and then I've looked at all of the theories and criticisms against them. And then I fought off the other side against that. So I'm just like neutral on this. So I've just come in with my own thoughts to put them to you to see what you say.
Go for it.
So I've just watched on Netflix a documentary about Henry Lee Lucas.
Okay.
He was described as the most prolific serial killer ever in America. Right. He was a drifter. He had an eye problem. And he was this skinny guy. And what happened was the Texas Rangers, the sheriffs, had this theory that he'd kill people. And then they started telling the world, we've got the biggest serial killer in the country. And cops from all over the country started to come to Henry Lee Lucas, and he would solve their crimes. Wow. He would say, you know, I killed her this way. I buried the body here. I did this and this and this. None of it was true.
No.
They had come in.
Sanity.
All these victims, family members, were so grateful that all these crimes had been solved.
Yeah.
And if you're a police person, to solve a serial killing, that is the crime of your career. That is going to make your career. To solve a child abduction, a high-profile child abduction like McCann, that is going to make your career. So there is forces at work within the police to satisfy the public, and that's what we saw. I mean, even to this day, the documentary finished with, even to this day now, victims of Henry Lee Lucas, the family members, are still trying to get Texas Rangers and all these other police to overturn the judgments about Henry Lee Lucas so they could find the real killers. And DNA over the years is slowly finding more and more of these killers over the years, the real killers. Some of them have been out there for 30, 40 years.
Wow.
My point here is then, with Madeleine McCann, you've got, you know, the crime of the century for the Portuguese police. It's not solved. Then you've got desperation and blame shifting back to the family.
Right.
You've got the arrest of the translator.
Right.
You've got the arrest of the guy who made the translator's website.
Right.
Those guys were exonerated. So how much police misconduct and police mistakes have you considered as well?
Well, I have. I've come across a great piece of information recently. I've considered a number of police mistakes, and there were errors. There were rookie errors in the early stages when they were doing things like, you know, DNA swabbing in the windows and dusting the windows, and they were doing things like not wearing protective gloves rookie errors that would happen in such a situation, because again, it's a small village. They're not used to necessarily dealing with such a major crime. So all those things took place, but I am in no doubt that the Portuguese police were demonized, and they were demonized A, because there was an element of racism actually from the British media towards them, real xenophobic stuff that took place, but there was also an element of protecting the McCanns because they were nice middle-class parents who made a mistake. And a lot of my colleagues in mainstream media were also going off on holidays and leaving their children in hotel rooms, and so they felt they had to protect the McCanns because they were protecting themselves as well. So there was that. And they gave the Portuguese police a kicking for that. And I think that actually the Portuguese police were much more sorted and much more together than they've been given credit for. As I say, there were errors. There definitely were errors. There's no doubt about it. But the biggest problem for the McCanns is that the Portuguese police started to home in on them. And that was a problem for them. The McCanns said they would never leave Praia da Luz without Madeleine. Well, they were made arguido, I think it was September the 3rd, and days later, maybe September the 7th, they were heading back to England suddenly from May, when they said, we're never going back, but you're suddenly made arguido and now you're going back to England. So all of that was really, really interesting. But then when they got back here, it was the level, this is what sort of grinds my gears, is the level of privilege they've been given and they've become accustomed to. They had a police escort from the airport when they arrived back in Leicester. Their children were taken to play parks where police sealed off play parks so that the children could play, that nobody else could go into the play parks. Things like that were taking place, right? This is levels of privilege that is going to wind up the general public, right? Also, don't forget, as soon as that money started rolling in on the Madeleine Fund, Kate's uncle said on television, I still have that clip, when he was asked what that money was for, he said probably legal fees, right? How a child's gone missing and you're thinking about legal fees? All of their priorities were bizarre. They trademarked her name, right? They fought to make her, you know, she was a ward of court because they wanted to access information that Leicester police had against them, right? And that was a legal way of going around it, right? So basically to kind of give up your rights to a degree as a parent. I don't know all the legalities of it, but she became a ward of court. And that then enabled them to try and get the information that they wanted about what was against them to do with Leicester police. So all their priorities were really odd. They are odd. They're odd anyway. And as people have told me in interviews, if they just said, look, we accept, we don't necessarily conduct ourselves in the way that other people might, but this is how we, that might have been different. But they constantly doubled down. They always went on the attack. They fought to shut down anybody who appeared to have any decent platform who was coming out against them. They used that Madeleine's fund in ways that were unconscionable on their public image, on their press and PR, on mortgage payments for their house, you know, just really unacceptable behaviour. So all of it adds to a picture. Dr. Phil, who I enjoy, I don't know if you know who Dr. Phil is, American doctor, right? But one of the things he said is that one thing on its own doesn't mean anything, but 10 things all together start to form a picture. With the McCanns, it's not 10 things, it's 50 things, it's 60 things. It's a lot of things that make you go, that doesn't actually make sense.
How much money did they raise?
In total?
Yeah.
Well, I think Madeleine's fund, the No Stone Unturned fund, at the last count was about 4 million.
And that's separate from what the government
spent. Oh, it's nothing to do with the government.
So there's almost 20 million spent then now.
Yeah, but if you think about their fund, it was very unique. First of all, they're not a charity because you can't be a charity. So they were a limited company. They were a limited company, but operating as if they were a charity. And if you look at the fine detail of the contract, it actually says quite they've not done anything illegal by paying their mortgage, by the way, because the contract actually says that they can spend that money however they deem fit, you know, in the sort of hunt for Madeleine. Well, if in the hunt for Madeleine means you don't go to work for a month, then pay your mortgage. Do you see what I'm saying? They can cover
it. So they've said loss of earnings then.
I don't know what the reason they gave for paying their mortgage with it.
They're not working. So with the legal fees then, do you know how much was spent on legal?
No, I don't. And some of the legal fees were picked up anyway, completely separate again, by Brian Kennedy, who owns the Double Glazing Company and is, you know, very wealth, self-made man.
Some of that money went to the private investigator that showed in the documentary.
Right. Now, the private investigators, they've had a series of corrupt private investigators. And in fact, their last private investigator is now dead, right? So again, there's been a series, there's a McCann death count as well, just like there is a Clinton death count, right? And also one of their biggest supporters, a guy called Nigel Nestling, massive supporter, online supporter, and this man trolled me and attacked me, went after me. He has now been convicted for having a lot of child abuse images, a lot, right? So we're talking about really gruesome people.
Do you think there are people who came in and just tried to like fleece them because they were desperate?
Well, Nigel Nestling wasn't directly involved with them, although he did set up some sort of crowdfunder and did raise some money. Don't know where that went. But he wasn't directly involved with them. Some people believe that McCanns have some of their representatives online because they say they're not online. So because obviously, if people really want information, they should go onto Twitter and look at the McCann hashtag, of which that they are divided into two groups called the pros McCanns and the anti McCanns. They were actually named by Jerry, I think, named them that. And the pro McCanns, the idea is that the pro McCanns are the people who believe the abduction story and the anti McCanns are the people who don't believe the abduction story. And I don't agree with the word anti McCanns because generally people aren't necessarily anti Kate and Jerry, but they are anti lies and they are pro Madeleine. But the McCann hashtag on Twitter is full of so much information. It's very, very clever, knowledgeable people have been posting on that for years now. And that has Like, these people will forensically examine, you know, one point of the story for 7 days. And it's brilliant the way they go about it. And so there's a lot of information on there. But we are talking about a story that attracted people who saw that they could, a lot of opportunists, right? I believe that Gordon Brown was an opportunist. I believe that Tony Blair was an opportunist. I believe people like, you know, Clarence Mitchell, who was brought in from the government to be their, you know, main PR guy, and ended up being with them for many, many years, and still is, still speaks on their behalf, and was paid, paid very handsomely by Kennedy, by, you know, Brian Kennedy. So there's been a lot of people who, Madeleine McCann is an industry. A lot of people have made money out of her, right? You know, and that includes, you know, people who have made money making films about her. I should say we spent 4 years making those documentaries. We've never made a penny. And I, as a journalist, I should make a living. But it was so important to me to get those stories out that we financed it other ways. So, but generally, Madeleine has been an industry to an awful lot of people. And don't forget, Kate is a spokesperson for Missing People and Jerry is a spokesperson for Hacked Off, who were involved in censorship of media. So,
yeah, I really like how you laid down the financial side of it and the industry.
Right.
Going back to the pro and against, one of the moving stories in your documentary was the story of Brenda.
Oh.
Can you explain who Brenda was, please?
Brenda Leyland. Brenda Leyland. Actually, Brenda Leyland's story makes me really, it makes me angry and it makes me sad all at the same time. Brenda Leyland was a, I think, a 50-something lady who lived in Leicester, lived in a village which was roughly 15 minutes drive from the McCann's house. Went to Brenda's. Brenda Leyland was on Twitter and on Facebook, and she was a anti-McCann, i.e. she didn't believe the abduction theory, and she forensically examined it. I have all Brenda's tweets. And Brenda was funny and clever and articulate. And but in March of, so when did this all happen? I might get the year wrong. It was either 2015 or 2016. But in March of that year, Brenda was outed by a number of pro-McCanns online. They were extremely vicious people. There is a small group of extremely vicious people. They are possibly funded from the McCanns, who knows, because they're diehards and they've been doing it for years. And they had compiled a dossier of people. I was in the dossier. A dossier of people who were anti-McCann, and they had given the dossier to police, and they had also given the dossier to Martin Brunt at Sky News. And Martin Brunt was given Brenda's information as one of the people on the dossier. Why did they choose her? And why didn't they choose me, for example? Why didn't Martin Brunt come and doorstep me? Why did he go and doorstep a lady in a small village, a divorcee on her own, right? So he went there, the might of Sky behind him, doorstep Brenda Leyland. Her doorstep, you know, so he was like, you're on, it was a report called, I think, The McCanns and the Trolls, which went out on repeat rotation for 24 hours on Sky. So it was massive. It wasn't a one-off news story. This woman went from being unknown on Twitter, asking questions about the McCanns, to being all over international press with her image all over international press. She left her village. She went to a hotel in Leicester, which I also went to stay in, because I basically wanted to trace her steps. It was very eerie, literally like a matter of weeks after, because I felt so, because she contacted me on Twitter and asked me questions. So we were in communication, not a huge amount, but she had contacted me. She took herself into a hotel. And from that point onwards, apparently she killed herself. She was found on the Saturday, roughly about 1:15, by a cop who had been alerted by the hotel staff. This cop, I went to the inquest. I didn't believe a word he was saying. He couldn't, I mean, he couldn't, I don't think he could lie straight in bed, this man. He was all over the place. And he claimed that he'd gone into her hotel room. She was lying on the bed. They claimed that she had killed herself with these sort of canisters and a hood that had, you know, So it's some sort of, I can't remember what the official term for it was.
Some kind of asphyxiation.
It is an asphyxiation, yes. But they said that she'd carried these big canisters into the hotel and everything.
Canisters of what?
Of like gas, you know, basically. You know, it was really weird. It was really weird. None of it stacked up. So they had the cop in, right, for the inquest, which was adjourned. But then they had the cop in for the inquest. And what he said, and it never rang true with me, he claimed that she was lying down on the bed with her iPad next to her, and he touched the iPad. Now, how many people don't have a code on their iPad, right? Because most people have a code on their iPad. Most people. I'm not saying that she did, but his story didn't ring true. He claimed he touched the iPad and it opened on a page about how to kill herself, right? So that was the Leicester cop.
Case closed.
Yeah, so that was it, right? And I just thought that just like such a series of events that are just
was there any search history prior to that of her showing signs of depression or suicidal tendencies?
She did. And that was the other thing that I didn't like at the inquest is they brought in a shrink who had dealt with her 10 years before to talk about how messed up her head was from 10 years before. It was awful. It was a diabolical inquest. The coroner, I had to laugh, was called Catherine Mason. I just thought, well, it would be a Mason, wouldn't it? And so the coroner of Leicester, but the coroner of Leicester, when Martin Brunt came into the inquest for the final inquest, was asked questions. The coroner flirted with Martin Brunt throughout. The coroner told the cop not to give too much graphic detail. Now, the thing is, from a journalist's perspective, in an inquest, you're supposed to hear it all. It's an open court, and it's the highest court in the land. You're supposed to hear it all, right? But we are guided by certain rules about what can be reproduced in publications or on air, because you don't want people to repeat a way that somebody has killed themselves, for example. So you wouldn't do a step-by-step process of how somebody's killed themselves. So that's the kind of detail that you should never obviously reproduce, but it's supposed to be said in court. And she guided the cop not to be too explicit with detail, which already my antenna was like, there is something desperately wrong here. I saw the inquest as a whitewash. To this day, I see it as a whitewash. So I issued a Freedom of Information request to them, three actually, which they've refused to answer any of them because they don't have to, because it is the highest court in the land, or at least one of. You know, a coroner is up there, and that to me was a whitewash. So anyway, Brenda died. But what was eerie was Brenda was said to have died on October the 4th. October the 2nd was when the Sky report went out. 24-hour rotation. October the 3rd, Jerry McCann was given a platform on, I think it was Radio 4, in which to talk about people like Brenda and say an example must be made of her, and the day after she was found dead. Mm. Right? So for people who knew this story, who already knew there were, as a death count around it, and Brenda was now the latest one, in such eerie circumstances, many people did not believe the circumstance of her death. But yes, she certainly had some mental health issues in her history, right? But so do I. But I'm not suicidal. So trust me, if I ever rock up dead, I've been suicided, because I'm not suicidal. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, Virginia Roberts just tweeted, I'm not suicidal.
Because she needed to. I'm glad she did that, because it's really important, right? Because they always do this. They go back in your history, they go, nutter, mental health problems. Actually, if you had them 10 years ago, you might not still have them. You might have been able to have dealt with them.
Everybody in the world's had a mental health problem at some point in their life.
Exactly. They brought in a shrink from 10 years before who hadn't seen her and was talking about her mental health issues from 10 years before. I felt they were there to assassinate her character, and it was a done deal from the get-go.
Did you speak to any of her next of kin or family friends?
No, nobody would. And in fact, it was quite tragic, because her son was on Twitter, was obviously clearly devastated, clearly wanted to distance himself. But what was awful was that his statement that was read out in court just sold her down the river. I mean, it made her just sound like, you know, a problem. You know, it was almost giving away too much personal information. You know, mothers and their children have problems, right? This happened. He wasn't suggesting that she was abusive or anything like that, but just that her mental health issues made her problematic. You know, it isn't impossible that she killed herself, but the series of events were weird.
And in this, the rest of the McCann body count then, are there any other weird?
Yeah, there was this soldier. Oh, I can't remember his name. But he actually went off to Portugal in the early days. He raised funds. Oh, God. he was found dead. I can't remember. This is why you need to go on the McCann hashtag, because somebody will watch this video and they'll go, I remember who she's talking about. But there's a series of people where very peculiar things have happened around the case. But Brenda was one of the most obvious ones, you know, to die, who got in the way of the story, basically. But what they did to her was terrible. And you see, I took issue with Hacktoff because Hacktoff's, which Jerry now represents and did at the time, their whole purpose really was to protect people who were demonised by the press, but they wouldn't protect Brenda because they had a dog in the race by Jerry McCann being their spokesman. And so that was a complete farce. That's Hugh Grant and his, you know, boys. But they should have stood up and said, the press have demonised this woman, that even if she did commit suicide, their steps pushed her to it. You can't blame other people if you commit suicide, right? That is always on you. But there is forms of culpability as well. And what happened to her? The press, international press, rocked up in her Leicester village. Can you imagine? You've gone from being anonymous on Twitter to being outed on Sky. Suddenly you're over the Daily Mail, you're in the Daily Star, you're all over the place. How devastating would that be? I did talk to the people in her village when we went there, and they said that she was like a church-going person. She was a staunch member of the community. She helped people. All of this stuff, they gave a really good sort of account for her being a decent, community-minded person, not the person that she was portrayed as. It's terrible, terrible. Should never have happened.
So I've got a new book out. It's called Clinton, Bush and CIA Conspiracies from the Boys on the Tracks to Jeffrey Epstein.
This is literally the most productive person I think I've ever encountered in my entire life.
In that book, I mentioned Johnny Gosch. I don't know if you're familiar with the sex trafficking, paedophile, political, all the way up to the White House ring back in the 1980s in America.
Yes, I know.
George H.W. Bush.
Right.
And George H.W. Bush made sure that the victims went to prison and none of the accomplices. So, with child sex trafficking, sometimes they get kids to order. The paedophiles say,
right,
want a little blonde girl, blue eyes,
this is true,
whatever. And looking at the theories on the McCann, the people who think the McCanns are innocent, the lead theory is the abductor.
Yeah.
Either an individual abductor or did it for a ring. Perhaps someone could have come in. You're talking about the dog. Someone could have come in, snuffed her right there or injected her with something, caused some blood to come out. What is wrong with that theory? Do you completely dismiss that, or do you
think I think it's a nonsense, and I'll tell you why it's a nonsense, because I've talked to enough Secret Service agents to tell me that child trafficking doesn't work on small little Portuguese villages with little blonde girls from England who are instantly going to become headlines. Anybody who knew anything knew that that would have been a problem from the so child trafficking actually generally works on with children who are not from those sort of families, children from, you know, families who have drug addicts in them, children who are neglected, children who are, you know, who are already looking for somebody else, perhaps to protect them in ways. There were too many problems, according to the Secret Service agents I've talked to, and I've talked to, God, must be six or seven about this. Not one of them believes this is an international child trafficking ring or stolen to order. Not one of them. They think that is a nonsense, because the very fact, as I say, go back to what I've just said, and that is in a little Portuguese village, affluent family, they're doctors, all of these things were headline worthy. In the same way as when they're talking about little Gregory and they said all the points came together to make it a story. It's the same with Madeline, but you sort of know that from the outset. You can see that sort of thing from the outset. And international child traffickers are not going to take a child who is already going to effectively have a spotlight on her before the get-go. Small little Portuguese village, British family, affluent. It has all the no-no signs of a child to steal. You show me, like, these children who are trafficked generally aren't from middle-class families. They're just not. They generally aren't, right? The older ones being trafficked are often runaways who are quite often from affluent families because they're trying to find something a bit more radical, a bit more alternative or whatever, right? So some of those can be, although generally trafficked people are generally not affluent at all, ever, and that includes children. And a little blonde child, they're not, when if a little blonde child is being, you know, brought to order, right, they are definitely not going to go after one who is literally has all the hallmarks of an international crisis. It wouldn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. People have tried to link Madeleine to all manner of people, as I say, the Podestas, Clement Freud, who did have a house in Praia da Luz, who Kate and Jerry became friendly with, very peculiar relationship, who now it would appear that Clement Freud was a paedophile, extensively so. But people keep trying to link Madeleine to everything except, like, all the cops I've talked to, they will tell you 9 out of 10 times when a child goes missing, it's either the family or the people around the family, right? So why didn't they start from that basis, given that that is normal general policing? Why did they choose not to start from that basis? Why do British cops not... You do see what I'm saying? It's like it's always been move it away from the parents, move it away from the friends, right? And I haven't articulated to the best of my ability why that trafficking isn't right. But honestly, every Secret Service agent I've ever talked to says it's an absolute nonsense. It's rubbish. There's absolutely no way. She would have just been too, almost kind of like too hot to take. It just wouldn't make sense. But I know that that's the big theory for people.
Okay, let's look at some other theories then. You talked about the circle of friends earlier and the guy who described her as angelic,
yes,
and
David
striking.
Payne. Yes.
So there's a class of criminals who are premeditated,
right,
and there's a class of criminals who are spontaneous. I met people from the spontaneous category, nothing to do with child sex trafficking, but met people, for example, guy, he's lived a perfectly normal life, he's like business owner, never been in trouble before, comes home, wife's in bed with another guy, snaps, kills them both, gets his gun, kills them both.
Right, crime of passion.
Or goes out, gets drunk, and does something they wouldn't normally do within the regular sober behavioural pattern. So they're at the restaurant, people are drinking, it's in the evening. We've also got the class of paedophiles who are thinking about acting out, but have never ever done it in their entire lives.
Yes.
So you've got these possible characters in the social circle.
Yes.
See the girl who's been described as cherubic, angelic, striking.
Yeah.
Decide to cross over that line.
Right.
How possible is that?
Yes. It is possible. I allow for the fact that I allow for all of those. What I believe is that Madeleine didn't leave that apartment alive. That's what I believe. Whoever, at the hands of whomever, however, that's what I believe. And I believe that based on what I consider to be substantial and significant information, which takes in the dogs, which takes in the observations of fantastic police, very thorough forensic work that has taken place, you know, very detailed work. So that is what I believe, essentially. Now, what led to that moment is what is hugely open to debate. Did she fall off the back of the sofa when she heard her dad outside in the street and crack her head? Because that's obviously where it was down the back of the sofa, or behind the sofa rather, where the blood and the cadaver was detected. And it was the sofa which kind of looks out over a window where Jerry was talking to a producer from the BBC when he'd gone to check her. So did Madeleine wake up in a daze because she'd been drugged, hear daddy's voice, stumble to the sitting room, crawl up onto the back of the sofa and fall down onto the stone tiles, crack her head? Did she die that way? Is that what happened? Or was she molested? Was she sexually abused? There are disturbing pictures that are available. There is a... This is the other thing that lent credence and weight to the idea that Madeleine was an abused, sexually abused child, is that the pictures and the images that Kate and Jerry chose to release of Madeleine were inappropriate pictures, right? They were coquettish. They were sexualized pictures of Madeleine in makeup of Madeline flinging her hair back, sucking lollipop, all things that looked sexualized. Even cops like Mark Williams Thomas, who did the Jimmy Savile exposé and stuff, and had been around the McCann case and very much part of the pro-abduction theory, even he had a problem with the imagery the McCanns were choosing to release. Why were they choosing to release such strange sexualized imagery of their children, of their daughter, their missing daughter, who they said had been taken by a predator, who the Gasper statement took 5 months to get to, who Gasper's basically saying that they believe that Jerry and Dr. Payne may well be paedophiles who had done something with Madeline. Why'd that take 5 months to get to Portuguese police? A series of really weird events that stopped things being investigated in the manner they should have. The images they released of Madeline were completely inappropriate. But more than that, there's an image of Madeline which alarms me, still alarms me, it haunts me. And I ask everybody to look for it. And it is highly likely it was taken in Portugal, right? In the day maybe prior to maybe on the Saturday or the Sunday when they arrived. She's got makeup on, but more than that, when you start to examine, and I've had the image looked at under a number of sort of lighting issues that we can look into the depth of the picture. She looks like she's got bruising on her cheek, right? And it's just really, really weird. People should look at it. There's something wrong with that imagery. And people often point to that imagery as a suggestion that she was being abused there. And it's almost like that was like a mascot picture. So there's some dark stuff that is
potentially... Was there anything in her medical history of injuries or bruises or anything?
No, not that I can think of. But obviously, she obviously had the thing in her eye. That was the thing that they were told not to make any big deal about, because if an abductor, because it was so unusual, the little fleck in her eye, right?
That was just a colour variation.
Yeah, it is. I can't remember what it's called, but basically it's like a line in her eye, right? Yeah. But it sets her apart. It's very unusual. It's very unique. And they were advised not to make a big deal about it, because any abductor would automatically probably feel they'd have to kill her because it would make her too visible. Mm. And Jerry did an interview with, I think it was Vanity Fair, in which he said, yeah, we were advised not to do it, but it was just too much of a good marketing idea. You know, and this is the way they were constantly thinking, you know, market, market, market our daughter. It was really weird. He said, these are not normal reactions. Like, going back to what you said, Sean, right? Everybody has different reactions when they're in shock, right? People have different reactions to grief and all manner of things, right? But their reactions were like no human reactions ever before. They were just really, really odd. So I think there is a big question mark over what happened to Madeline before she potentially died in that apartment. A massive question mark.
Are you leaning towards there was a sexual assault and a murder, or it was just a child killing?
I don't believe it would have just been a child killing for no reason. No. My theories change according to whatever information is coming, because that's what you should do about theories, obviously, is they should adapt and alter depending on what sort of information you get coming in. If she died, as some people believe, that she, that they were forced to hide her because her body would have basically given up all the secrets about what had happened to her.
Who's they?
The people around her, the McCanns, their friends, whatever. So the belief is that they had to get rid of the body because, unfortunately, the body contained all the information, whether she'd been drugged, about the abuse, all of those different things. It is highly likely, given that Jerry is a heart surgeon, it's highly likely that if she fell off the back of that chair, this is one of the theories that I have, if she fell off the back of that chair, right, and he came in and found her, it is highly likely that he could have, I don't know, he could have opened her up, whatever, he could have opened her up, tried to get her heart moving or whatever, and then they couldn't allow her to be found anyway because they would have tampered with her in order to try and revive her. There's all manner of theories, but it is evident and it is clear to me that her body could not be found.
That tells the story.
Because that's the story.
So they're at this meal, Dan, and who else is back? There's other kids in the apartment.
There's other kids, yeah.
There's two more kids, are there?
Oh, there's more. Let me see. I mean, I think there were somebody will correct me on this, I'm sure. I think there were seven children.
Seven children?
Yeah.
In how many rooms?
Well, they had four apartments. So the McCanns had, let's see, McCanns had three children. David Payne and Fiona Payne had two children. So that's five children. Matthew Oldfield, I think they, did they have one or two? Scarlett. And then the, who was the other family? I think it was seven children in total. They were all toddlers. Madeline was the oldest. She was.
And were they in various apartments, or were they all in the same that night?
Well, now that's where it gets really interesting. They claim they were all in separate apartments, right? But actually, you look at the first police photographs and everything, and also the police statements. They talk about how the twins were brought back to the apartment, and they were moved to this, and that it's very unclear. Another theory is obviously they had to say they were leaving the children, otherwise you can't have an abduction. So that you have to have an alibi. So the neglect of them leaving the children, that might have been well worth them catching it for neglecting their children, because at least then they're not catching it for harming a child to death, right? So the neglect is potentially an alibi, because without them leaving the children, there can be no abduction, right? But if you look at the police statements, on most nights, there's at least one member of the gang who doesn't go to the restaurant, right? For various reasons, upset stomachs, sickness, this, that. There's usually at least one member who doesn't go. And one of the theories is that that member stayed behind each night and stayed with all the children in one apartment.
Ah.
Right?
Well, that didn't happen on the night in question.
Well, no, it might have done, because don't forget, they, by the time the police arrived, closer, they called the police at 10:40. Kate raised the alarm at 10 o'clock. The police first registered call was 10:41, right? They said they called immediately. In those 41 minutes, actually what happened was the McCanns and their friends trampled through the apartment repeatedly. They messed up the crime scene. Now, as doctors, surely they understand about DNA and forensic evidence, right? That's six doctors messing up a crime scene.
But if your kid's gone missing, you would just panic and just run everywhere, wouldn't you?
Yes, yes, yes. But would you, though? In such a small apartment, have you seen the size of that apartment?
Because you just assumed they'd walked off somewhere.
Well, and there were so many different things. You know, it's like none of it made sense, right? So were they actually messing up the crime scene so that it would be so contaminated, right? But they also prepared two timelines of the night, which was written on a children's colouring book, right? Who needs to prepare timelines, right? So they did all manner of stuff in preparation to talk to the police. It was really weird. Really weird stuff.
So we don't know who was actually in the room with Madeline and how many people were in that whole apartment on that night. It's all jumbled.
It's all jumbled. They say different things, don't they? They say that Matthew...
What's the official story?
The official story that Matthew Oldfield was the last person to go into the apartment. He didn't go into their room, although for some reason he was able to see, I think, the twins breathing. And he described the cot, which the cot didn't actually... When you look at the police photos, the cots don't look like the way that he's described, because he's talking about mesh around all sides. But actually, one of the cot, I think, has a completely plain side. You certainly wouldn't be able to see twins breathing in the dark.
How old were the twins?
Sean and Amelie would have been, I think they were 18 months.
Okay, so they're not going to witness anything.
No. And also the twins, this is the other interesting thing, is that when the police came, one of the observations of the police was that the twins never woke up. So they were probably highly sedated. Right. So the twins, with all this action and people moving around the apartment looking for Madeline, the twins never woke up.
So the twins have a blood tested.
Three months later, the twins' hair was tested. Now, Kate and Jerry, as doctors, know that by 3 months, any drugs are out of the system, those kind of drugs. Right. So all of these things didn't add up. These weren't people who lacked knowledge about forensic evidence, about examinations or any of those things. They knew all of that stuff, and their actions were completely contrary. Their actions were all obstacles.
Do we know for a fact that they were at the meal? Or is that just their word?
I do believe they were at the meal, actually. There's enough. If you look through the police reports, there's enough of the members of staff who saw them there, really. Although there was some confusion about how long Jerry was there for. There's some confusion. And, excuse me. And if he was able See, the other thing is if she had died earlier in the week, right, they couldn't have got rid of her earlier in the week, because if she'd have been found before they reported her missing, something's wrong there, right? So they could only hypothetically or theoretically get rid of her once she'd been reported missing. Do you see what I'm saying? Or within that time frame. Because if she's found before she's reported missing, there's a problem there, right? So do you see what I'm saying? So they reported her missing 10:41, and the Smith family claimed to have seen somebody who looked like Jerry. They said, I think 60 to 80% they believed it to be Jerry carrying a child, Martin Smith did, down towards the sea. I've since interviewed people who live around that area. I stayed next to the church that they had access to, their own personal key to, because some people believe that the body was buried there because the man who arranged it, I came from Leicester and knew them. So these are, there's a lot of people who seem to know them in Praia da Luz as well already, you know, or they have connections there already. So it is the most peculiar story. It is the most peculiar story, but I can't, with all the information I've gathered about it, nothing makes sense about her being trafficked, nothing whatsoever. And oftentimes the simplest things is the truth, right? And the simplest thing is that they did carry on going out. They did over cowpole them or whatever. And don't forget, Kate was an anaesthetist. So goodness knows what she was carrying to put people to sleep, right? So, but seeing as it didn't work very well the night before, according to their own account, because Madeline woke up and at least one of the twins did, is it possible that on Thursday night when they went out, they decided to give her extra?
So you're saying that regardless of any form of abuse, it could have been a drug overdose death, yeah, and then he just cast her into the sea.
Yeah, yeah, highly likely. Highly likely. But there's also other stuff that's really, really peculiar. I have this image and it's really odd. There was a Channel 4 documentary done about them. It was all very, very soft in the early days. And they have actually, for a split second, but because I'm a journalist, I capture things like that. For a split second, it shows a part of their house and actually looks like there is an ashes urn on one of their mantelpieces. And it definitely is about Madeline, and there's all stuff. It's all surrounded by Madeline, but there's this box in front of it. I would like to know what's in that box.
Yeah, it just boggles my mind. It's such a mystery.
It is such a mystery. It's such a mystery, but we've also been, you know, hoodwinked. We've been hugely hoodwinked. Look, Kate and Jerry McCann, let us not forget, at the end of the day, right, even according to their own story, they neglected their children night after night after night, and they have never, ever been held to account for it, and so did their doctor friends. So that, at the very least, they should have been done for child neglect, at the very least. And what the Portuguese said was they felt so sorry for them that they didn't want to go there, you know? So,
and you pointed out about Gordon Brown. So the politicians come in then and they just want to get votes and show that they're helping the case and doing something about it and satisfying the public.
Of course they do. Look, we've just gone through a general election, right? Look what those politicians are prepared to do. You have Joe Swinson, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, who can no longer tell you what a woman is, because the top two funders of the Lib Dems, incidentally, are Ferrings, and which is puberty blockers, are involved in the whole trans issue, and chest binders. So those are major funders to Lib Dems. And suddenly Joe Swinson, the leader of the Lib Dems, can't remember what a woman is. So we know that politicians will do anything. They will.
How big are puberty blockers these days?
How big are they?
I mean, like, how widespread is that use?
Much more than we think, for certain. They keep lying about it. They keep saying, I mean, the Lib Dem people were on this week saying that you have to be 16 to have puberty blockers. Sorry, but the clue is in the title. Puberty blockers. You take them before puberty begins. They're idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. They say any old nonsense. Children of three are being put on a transgender pathway, and by the age of 11, 12, they're being given puberty blockers, and there are no long-term studies for it, and it's absolutely obscene. So we know politicians will do and say anything at all, you know, to get him. Gordon Brown was no exception. Although I do think, some people think Gordon Brown has a very dodgy history, you know, obviously. But I don't think he was as involved as some people think he was. I don't. I think he was just trying to look good as a prime minister. Yeah. I think that's what he was. I think that was the case.
So you're talking about puberty blockers. This brings us into the third section then of the what I planned to talk about, which was the cancer industry documentary.
Oh, my goodness. What time are we up to?
We've got about half an hour
go
left.
Go on then.
So let's. What got you interested in the cancer industry in the first place?
Well, a number of things, including the fact that my business partner is highly knowledgeable about cancer, but alternative cancer treatments. Both my fathers, my stepfather and my actual father, both died with cancer, so that interests me. I always saw it as a business. I couldn't understand how they're now saying that one in two people in our lifetime are going to get cancer. I mean, we are talking about a billion dollar industry. And so I wanted to look at, I didn't want to necessarily look at how true is cancer. I wanted to look at the business of it, how it was functioning. I talked to scientists, I talked to doctors, I talked to oncologists, surgeons, I talked to cancer patients, just everybody along the cancer chain, people who were treating themselves, people who had been banged up for treating others, just everybody that I could get my hands on, really. And what I concluded, unquestionably, and also with all the information, is that Cancer Research UK is, I mean, crook by name, crook by nature, as far as I'm concerned. That is the most crooked of charities. It's a business. So I think for the last period, I think it was 576 million they made or something for the year. So they have Race for Life and they have all these major, major fundraisers. And then they give money, obviously, to scientists and various other people who are carrying out tests. But they're not looking at alternative things. They're not. I mean, my big thing was, why aren't you looking more at cannabis? Oh, well, we have. But you see, look what they've done with the whole cannabis issue now. So Theresa May and her husband, had shares in cannabis production. And we export. We're one of the biggest exporters of cannabis.
GW Pharmaceuticals.
Correct.
I've got shares in them.
Have you really? Yeah. Well, yeah. More power to your elbow.
Not the level that I used to be. But I got a small amount of money in them.
Well, yeah. But look at the problems here. We don't even really, what the stuff that Holland and Barrett and all of them sell, it has no actual value to it at all. It's really just a placebo.
Stock market tip, GW Pharma was trading up over almost $200 a share. It's back down now around $100 a share. So.
Stop market boy.
I did tell everyone to sell when the Canadian, when they legalized, I told everyone to sell all your Canada shares and they've gone down a lot.
Right.
A fraction of the price right now. So it's a good time to get to
But
back,
you see, they
down.
Don't want to explore that, do they? They don't really, really want, look, we've seen what's happened. Children have, you know, 10, 15 fits a day. As soon as they get some decent cannabis oil, right, or the strands that they need, it stops. So we know it works. This is nature, right? Nature works. But it is a big industry and it all plays into it. And so obviously then you have the Cannabis Act and the Cannabis Act from the 1930s. That doesn't allow the promotion of a treatment. So even if somebody came up with an incredible alternative treatment, there is a problem about promoting it. You can only promote it to interested parties, i.e. the medical establishment, the political establishment. You can't promote it to the public. So it's basically an industry that's been sewed up for an awful long time. They're giving us cancer. Cancer is in our food. Cancer is, all of these things are cancerous. The worst thing for us is food. No doubt about it. After the war, it went from food to food-like products. So that's what people are eating. People are not eating food by and large. They're eating food-like products, right? That is mass produced, that has zero nutritional value, that is extremely harmful for us. And definitely food is problematic, but that doesn't necessarily answer the question of why, for example, young children get cancer or why somebody would get cancer much later in life, right? So you have to start to look at what is it that children are getting now that we weren't necessarily getting before. Well, we know that the vaccine intake has increased exponentially for children. We should not ignore that at all. We must be very, very clear that there is a problem, that the doctors go to schools that are funded by pharmaceutical companies. So they have to sell the wares. That's how it works. That only happened around the 1930s. That was about 100 years ago that started happening, when the pharmaceutical giants started to get more involved within medicine. And that's why medicine is the way it is. In some parts of the country now, you can get no alternative treatment at all within the NHS. And it is all about medicine. We know that the three main treatments for cancer are cancerous, which is insane. You know, none of it makes any sense. We know that at a minimum, I mean, you know, according to records that we've looked at, a minimum of one in two people who have had breast cancer and it's gone, it's coming back again, and oftentimes in the other breast. So there's something that the medical industry, and it is an industry, is doing that is not assisting us in the appropriate way with cancer. And in fact, one of the surgeons I spoke to said that cancer is no longer seen as like a disease. It's now just seen as sort of a long-term diagnosis that you will live with. It's chronic illness now, as opposed to anything else. And it's just something that they will keep managing for the rest of your life. But it is what people need to do is people need to, and I know it's really hard, don't get me wrong, but people need to eat as pure a diet as possible, right? You know, in terms of where they source their food, right? You know, it is really essential that we avoid as much processed food as possible. That's the danger. Processed food is really the danger. And now, of course, and
look at the fire and energy Sonia has on organic food. You're a living advertisement.
Well, but only recently, because it is expensive. It is expensive, but I've realized that it's that important to me that I make other sacrifices.
Your health is your wealth.
Because my health started to deteriorate, age-related health. And when that starts to happen, you start to realize, you know, the importance of keeping yourself healthy. But cancer is an industry. I would not advise anybody to, you know, other than surgery. Surgery, if they discover a cancer lump, there are many reasons why you should have that removed, right? But everything else that goes with cancer, you know, the treatments, they are cancerous. They are carcinogenic. The medications are so carcinogenic, they have to use 2-3 pairs of gloves even to handle the medication. And they're feeding that to people. So what does that tell you? So that's why I wanted to do the business of cancer. That was really important to me, because I don't just want to, you know, investigate. I want to investigate anything that is corrupt and that is damaging to our way of living, really. And cancer is definitely one of them. And it is the biggest killer in the world now. And one in two people is projected to get it in their lifetime, which is extraordinary. Because if you think that's gone from one in 30 people, I think it was in the 60s, roughly around that, to one in two, how did this happen? We've got more money than ever. We've got better equipment than ever, better Medicare. How could this possibly be?
So you've raised so many points there. I don't know where to start. I'll start with, I agree 100% with everything you've just said. And cancer did impact my family. My sister had a baby who was 1 year old and was diagnosed with leukemia. That used to be a death sentence. My sister basically she was a journalist. She had to quit her job and she was just living in a hospital for 2 years.
Wow.
Huge credit to the people at Great Ormond Street Hospital, because the survival rate now with childhood leukemia is 90%, but it is those grueling treatments that you described.
Grueling.
The chemo and the port in the little, and the taking the stuff out the spine and getting the, all that stuff that my sister had to go through. It was really traumatic, and I saw her face just change, you know, but now everything's back on track in their lives. Thank God for that. Vaccines. I did a clip with David Icke about what he said about vaccines, and it was one of the most controversial clips I put on the channel.
I'm sure.
A lot of people downvoted it. A lot of people also supported it. Now, I got the 6 pricks when I was in school, the vaccines. And I'm not against vaccine science. You're talking about the big pharma industry now, how they have monopolized the world.
100%.
All of the academic institutions,
yeah.
All of the doctor's offices.
Yeah.
They're all incentivized now by big pharma to push their products, push the vaccines. push this and that. In America now, kids are having dozens of vaccines, up to 80, 90 vaccines.
It's ridiculous.
If the pharmaceutical companies give someone a drug as a vaccine, they have no legal liability for what happens, and it even says on the label, but they don't give the people the labels, that this can cause death,
well,
brain damage,
exactly,
and all this stuff. Now, recently, a lady contacted me, and we're going to have her on the podcast in the new year, and her baby was completely normal,
yeah,
completely healthy.
Right.
She had a bunch of vaccines on one day. She thought she was just doing the right thing for her child.
As you do.
Her child got incredibly sick, and it spiraled out of control and died. And what did the authorities do? Arrested the dad for baby shaking.
Right.
And she's saying there are hundreds of people now in prison in this country for baby shaking. And there are thousands in prison in America for baby shaking. Because they call you, if you say the kid got sick after the vaccine, right away all the doctors gang up against you because they don't want any legal liability.
Right.
The authorities are brought in to look at the death. They side with the doctors.
Right.
You're some kind of conspiracy theorist for saying it was the vaccines. It was obviously a family member because, like you said earlier, child deaths, it's usually a family member. That is the natural progression for the police to think that. So this woman is in this horrific situation whereby her kids died and they're looking at the husband as the culprit.
Yeah.
So
terrible.
Even though I believe in vaccine science, Big Pharma has took this to the point now where people are getting over-vaccinated.
100%.
And my problem is now with over-vaccination and the greed behind that, slamming a newborn child with all of these toxic ingredients, even in neuroscience, you know, it's obvious that that is an overload and it's causing some kind of brain damage, possibly. And they say in the disclaimer that comes with it, the written disclaimer, all of the side effects are right there, the things that can possibly happen to people.
Yeah.
They're not even denying it.
Why would we have a vaccine fund? We have a vaccine fund, which we pay out to people because of vaccine damage, you know, vaccine injury. So, which obviously they don't promote, but we do. Look, don't get me wrong. It is hard work being a parent, right? When you bring a life into this, in this world, you want to do what is right. And it seems like the right thing to do is to follow that level of guidance. I didn't. I couldn't. So I am largely anti-vax. But by the same token, I don't judge other people. Right. But I also know there are a lot of myths around. They have myths. So one example is herd immunity, this whole idea that you need to get a greater proportion of people vaccinated in order to protect the whole herd. That is a lie. That is an absolute lie. And it's stuff like that that I object, that sort of level of propaganda. I hate the incentives that doctors get where they, you know, get paid for, you know, for vaccinating people, all that sort of incentivization that takes place. But there's more than that. There's levels of corruption. What I showed in the business of cancer was how doctors were being wined and dined by big pharmaceuticals, taken on big holidays, you know, given, you know, I mean, salaries, well, they don't call them salaries, obviously, but, you know, nice little bungs and all manner of stuff. All that's taking place. We know all that's taking place. It is highly corrupt. It is, my big objection is, I think, the same as yours, and that is the sheer volume of vaccines that we're putting into children right now. Look, there are some brilliant people online who are online because their children are vaccine damaged in the same way as the person you're talking about. These people didn't make it up. They know what they're talking about. And we need to look at it more thoroughly. I have doctors in the business of cancer who are completely opposed to Dr. Sarah Myhill. I think she's in the business of cancer. And Sarah Myhill was taken before the British Medical Association because she said that HRT was bad science. Right.
What is HRT?
HRT is the hormone replacement therapy that women usually get when they're going through the menopause. Right. She said that is really bad science. It's really dangerous. It messes with your hormones in a way that is really, you know, inappropriate and la, 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 la. She got in trouble. She was put before, you know, a board at the British Medical Association, and she won. Right. She won because she was able to prove with all of her evidence and all of her information that actually there's an awful lot of bad science which is taking place. And she got reprimanded because she wasn't dishing out enough prescriptions to her patients. She was advising her patients on how to eat better, how to exercise better, you know, a whole overview of how to look after yourself. And she got reprimanded for not giving out enough prescriptions. So that tells you, if that happens to a doctor, it tells you what we're dealing with, right? There should not be a number to how many prescriptions. There should not be a number to how many vaccinations. Do you know what I mean? It should work on an individual basis. Shouldn't have targets, but they've got targets. So, and it's a massive, massive industry. The pharmaceutical industry is, what is it, the top three industries? I mean, it's massive.
Oil, drugs, weapons, pharmaceuticals.
There you go.
Yeah, drugs legal and illegal. They're the three biggest, aren't they?
Yeah, and the irony is that a lot of the drugs that are illegal are, in my opinion, a lot safer for you than the drugs that are legal. So I am a minimum legal drug user. Not suggesting for a second I'm an illegal drug user.
No felonies here.
But I don't take many sort of medicines. I don't. I will avoid them as much as I can, because the problem is, as Sarah Myhill says, the pharmaceutical industry, in the same way as the cancer medicine, is set up in such a way that the medicines are only made to suppress. They are not... We are customers. That's the whole point. That for the pharmaceutical industry, they create customers, not cures. That's the point.
So to create profit growth for the shareholders, the pharmaceutical companies need constant sales,
yes,
and patents are renewing, and they need to promote new drugs.
Every 20 years. So that's, again, why it happens with the drugs as well, because that patent only lasts them for 20 years, right? So then they've got it, and that's what happens. They have to just keep replenishing, basically, you know, and it's brilliant the way they do it, but it is one of the most corrupt industries. And what I object to is how very little the media actually shows about what is going on in the pharmaceutical industry, how often they get sued. They get sued for a lot of money, you know, for the particularly the vaccinations, and the vaccination programs are huge, you know. So, and don't forget what will happen with polio. You know, with polio, we've now been able to trace a legitimate link from the polio vaccines through to cancer. So we know it's happened. It has happened. They were given, you know, they were given stuff from rhesus monkeys to people in vaccinations. For goodness sake, still are.
So in my research into the war on drugs, it took me into the pharmaceutical industry. Mm. And their philosophy is, you know, our customers are only, there's only a minority of people sick at any time. They're our customers. They're our, you know, our guaranteed customers. How do we target the majority, though? We can give them vaccines. We can tell them you're potentially going to get something at some point and give them vaccines. Or we could tell them they're going to potentially get something at some point and give them other drugs such as statins.
Right.
So in America right now, I think like more than half the population are on some kind of pills from doctors.
Of course.
Whether psychiatric medication, statins, or something else.
100%. Look, one of the big things about what was going on with the, I'm going to make it quick, but what was going on with the election was the whole issue of the privatisation of NHS and what has been going on there. Well, I started campaigning against the Health and Social Care Bill in 2012 when they were trying to push through the act, which they did, about how they were sort of privatising and because what, you know, the way they've been able to get around it and say we haven't privatised it is basically what they've done is they've offloaded all the services to private companies that a lot of the politicians have shares in or have some sort of involvement in. But it is the same thing again. And what we must remember is that industries survive because they are able to set up a certain pattern. So, for example, charities survive. A successful charity should have no use once it has fulfilled its remit. So, for example, a charity like Stonewall, once they manage to get lesbian and gay sexual equality, that charity should be over and done with. But that wasn't enough for them because we have greedy buggers in these places. And so they were like, what's the next thing that we can add to this? Let's add trans to it and queers to it. And that's what they did. They added the T and the Q to it. And then so they could continue, you know, feeding, you know, at the trough. And it's the same way with the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry would not survive if it cured us. It wouldn't. So all it does is suppress whatever it is we've got, probably trigger something else we're dealing with. Right. So, you know, I mean, I'm dealing with all manner of things at the moment. I've got surgery that's going to be due soon. And I'm doing everything I can to avoid actual medication. I'm doing, you know, I'm doing better yoga, I'm doing better physio, everything I can to make the surgery better. They want me to start. I mean, they're introducing all manner of stuff now pre-surgery. The nurse the other day gave me this thing. She said, put it up your nose every day, a week before surgery. I said, what is it? She said, well, I don't know, but it will prepare you better for surgery. I said, I'm not just shoving something up my nose. But people do. People do. If somebody with a, it's proven anyway, it's actually proven, there was a brilliant, I've got to tell you this, and that is, it's proven that if you put on a white coat and carry a clipboard, people will answer all manner of questions that you ask them because they think you're an authority.
Yeah, the pharmaceuticals, they don't want you healthy. They don't want you dead. No. They want you somewhere in between.
They do. They want you in a chronic state. Because in a chronic state of maintenance, that means they can keep propping you up with, you know, the heart rate pills, right? So this and, you know, and how many cases of diabetes have we got? I mean, this is the thing people have to look at about the huge influx of vaccinations. And that is, we are now dealing with issues that we simply weren't dealing with in the numbers that we were dealing with before. The neurological issues, autism, all these sort of things. We are having massive explosion around us of disorders and illnesses that we simply didn't have before. So everybody says, well, we got rid of TB. Yeah, but how come we've got all of these though? Where did these all come from?
I mean, the proof is in that America spends the most on healthcare in the entire world.
Right.
And it's got the sickest people in the world.
Right.
They're not curing people.
Yeah.
They're making them worse.
No, exactly.
Doctors now are a leading cause of death in America.
Well, they are. What's the word? What's the word for it? Death by doctor. Oh, it's a great word for it. But actually, death by doctor is a huge cause of death. You know, I mean, surgeons leave tools in people's bodies and sew them back up again and do all manner of stuff. So death by doctor is a huge cause. But we have to start being adults. That's what we have to do. I think 2020, we have to start questioning people more. Look, the kind of people who watch your podcast are discerning people anyway, generally. That's been my experience of them. So they do ask a lot of questions. But, you know, the more people that they can talk to and get to ask questions and not accept everything at face value. And I wanted to just say, I have to say this before we finish, Sean, because this is my clarion call for 2020. Please, children, they are from 2020, they are introducing new sex education into schools, which is going to be more diabolical than ever before. And parents can only opt out the sexual relationships part for their children. They can't opt out of the relationships part. But some of the stuff is really dire and it's really frightening. You need to find out what's happening. The No Outsiders program is going to come more into effect in 2020 than ever before. We're going to have more drag queen story time than ever before. Grown men dressed up as women going into libraries and teaching three-year-olds about gender fluidity. It's happening all over. Happened in Rochdale last week. A performer called The Night Bus, right? The name alone should be enough to tell you this might not be somebody appropriate around children. When you go online, do a Google search of The Night Bus, who they thought was appropriate for three-year-olds and five-year-olds in a library. The Night Bus, the imagery online of The Night Bus, public pictures on Instagram and wherever. I mean, you know, basically simulating sex on stage and all manner of stuff, public nudity, all this stuff. And you're going in appropriated as a woman to teach children about gender fluidity. So 2020, you know, children are always my big thing. I always have to bring it back to children. 2020 is going to be the biggest year so far when they are going to make a sweep on our children's minds. It is, I know it. I can, because it's been building up to it, right? We now know over the last 3 years, 30 clinicians have left the gender identity service because children are already being given, you know, hormones before they should. The whole process of changing gender has kicked off big, you know, so all of this stuff, 2020, like never before, I truly believe we are going to have to rally round and protect our children from school, literally protect our children from school, you know, and from libraries and all these environments where they are bringing in sexualizing content. So, you know, that I need, it has to be a clarion call. We have to protect children. Look out for the No Outsiders program. You know, so whatever the doctors are doing, whatever any of them are doing, parents do still have a say. Parents still must stand in, you know, birth certificate is obviously problematic because the birth certificate itself makes the child of the state. And that is a problem. But if you don't register your child, then you'll get in trouble that way anyway. So they have us right from the get-go. But parents still have a bigger say, whether that's with a doctor or whether that is, you know, with a school. But please, I mean, Sean, I can't stress that enough. What they are planning to put through in the sex education lessons over the next year is scary as anything. Really scary.
I've got tons more questions to ask you, but we've only got time for one.
I know.
You mentioned that you have met people or interview people or aware of people who have treated people with cancer with cannabis oil,
yes,
and ended up in prison. Let me just give you a little summary of my interest in this then. So writing a War On series of books, and I'm potentially going to write a book called A War Against Weed. So all my research into this went over to the Hemp Museum over in Holland, and there's a case of Dennis Hill I'm going to get to. So Queen Victoria said that cannabis was the most medicinal plant on the planet.
Right.
Earliest drug laws prior to the federal laws that you talked about earlier were pharmaceutical societies in California did not want people growing free medicine in their own backyards.
Right.
So make cannabis illegal. Right. You described the Cannabis Tax Act. Harry Anslinger brought that in through the racism, etc.
Yeah.
And he was the undersecretary of the treasury of the federal government. And they had investments in plastics, paper,
right,
fledgling pharmaceuticals.
Right.
They wanted to keep it out. To this day, cannabis is a Schedule I substance in America.
Yeah.
More harmful than crystal meth. Shocking. More harmful than cocaine, with no medicinal value whatsoever. There's pressure on Trump right now to reduce it. Perhaps he might do that to get those votes. But there's a big lobby because we're seeing legalization and decriminalization all over the world. Politicians have loved holding babies and having photo ops.
Yeah.
You described the babies that have the seizures. Politicians can't go up against sick babies. And it's the sick babies like Charlotte in America, the Charlotte oil that I've got,
right,
the CBD oil, it's got very low THC, has caused this tidal wave now of decriminalization, legalization at the state level, which is the people voting for it,
right,
because of the medical. Little kids having the seizures, their parents got to move house,
yeah,
and give up their jobs, yes, to go to Colorado to get the medicine to save their lives, to stop them going into comas and dying. It's absolutely obscene. Now, I've written I put a video on YouTube called How Cannabis Oil Fights Cancer, based on the work of Dennis Hill, a biochemist.
Right.
He was diagnosed with prostate cancer. In his entire career in conventional biopharmacy, he'd never heard of cannabis oil. So he was scheduled for chemotherapy. A hippie out of San Fran, I think, a hippie friend, a female friend, said, look, do the cannabis oil.
Right.
And he's like, what? What are you talking about? How can I never heard this? It's got to be ridiculous. She's like, no, and explained it all to him, run it by him. He remembers smoking weed when he was younger. So he wasn't completely terrified of anything to do with cannabis. He canceled his chemo. Now, a lot of people, and I've got friends who had cancer and got the cannabis oil, the THC oil, but had the chemo as well.
Wow.
So then you say, who, you know, which one cured it?
Yeah.
The cannabis. You can't. Yeah. Dennis Hill canceled his chemo.
Right.
Did the cannabis oil. And got the x-rays, and over time it was completely cured. And if anyone wants to research Dennis Hill, he's very articulate. His videos are on YouTube. He's got a website. And if you've got if you've got cancer, don't send questions to me about this, because I'm not allowed to give medical advice.
No, nor me.
Send them to Dennis Hill. Look up Dennis Hill and find out what Dennis Hill did.
I would recommend Keith Mann's book as well. Keith Mann, I interviewed for The Cancer Doc.
Is he in the UK?
Yes. And Keith is actually, I adore Keith, because Keith was one of the original people who broke all the beagles out from being experimented, and he was banged up inside for doing all that. He was, you know, breaking into all these places where they're experimenting on animals and setting them free, which is always good for me. You know, cannabis, at the same point that the pharmaceutical companies were funding the medical schools, that's when they started to produce propaganda, anti-cannabis propaganda. And it was very racist. Remember, they talked about how it would send you insane, how it was only black people who had it.
And they'd want to rape every white woman
in sight. That's right, absolutely. And that, we still have that hanging over us. People still think that, you know, the cannabis is going to make you behave like this. Well, I'm not here to promote cannabis, although my only Ofcom is because I promoted cannabis.
People hear cannabis and they think you might be recommending smoking it.
Yes.
The plant has got, what, over 100 ingredients that can be used for medicinal purposes that have not been researched because holding it at a Schedule 1 substance prevented any research into it.
Obviously, Rick Simpson, one of the original people who broke through with the whole issue of you know, the pure cannabis oil, and I believe cured his own cancer as well. So people are curing themselves. People are actually curing
Rick Simpson's story is in my new book, Clinton, Bush and CIA Conspiracies, and he started to cure people. And he got run out of Canada,
right,
didn't he?
Right.
But my question for you is, you said you've met people who've been incarcerated for helping people medically.
Yeah.
Who are these people?
Well, there's one recently who I didn't meet. Now, he was the most famous one who's been... I've met a number of people. I met two brothers.
What had they done?
They had been treating... You see, the problem is you can't say you can cure. So they had been treating a number of people in a private clinic. And they were only taking, they weren't taking, like they were fundraising costs for beds and all manner of stuff. So they were literally only taking the cost of the treatment. They were arrested.
THC oil?
Yes.
THC oil. THC is the active ingredient.
Yeah, that's the problem.
But it's also in my video, Dennis Hill's work, what he said is the THC goes in. Your immune system can't identify that it's cancerous cells. The THC changes the identity and it makes your immune system recognize it.
Right.
The CBD oil, which is legal, there's a 1-2 punch because that stops it from spreading.
Yes, exactly.
But it's the THC oil that the cancer patients need the most. And it's illegal. And that is a sin on humanity.
Yes. Well, but I mean, the fact that you would make a plant illegal in the first place is outrageous. That tells us all we need to know. But the most famous person who's been arrested, actually, he was in sight. See, the brothers who never want me to name them, but the two brothers, they weren't in sight very long. But the most famous person is recently, and his partner has also been arrested as well. And he was quite public. Now, what was his name? He's in the dock. He's in the dock. I can't remember his name, but he was put away. And actually, what was awful about that, I apologize, not remember his name, but what was awful about his arrest was that once he was arrested, the mechanicals agency attached to the government, which has to do with all of this, they released a report where they were like joyous that they'd managed to bang up this person. David something. It will come back to me, but it's in the Business of Cancer doc anyway. But they were curing people. They were curing people. And this is the problem. Is the
it
moment
doesn't
that
harm
you
the
say,
surrounding tissue and do all those things that are going to cause the cancer.
There's a lot of incredible people working with cancer. A lot of incredible people. A lot of the time they certainly can't work in England. They have to work either offshore, you know, in little islands or whatever around there. But I'm in no doubt whatsoever that cancer is an industry, that cancer is supported by, by the doctors that, you know, I mean, there were a few renegade ones who was prepared to speak to me for my doc and everything. But ultimately, we are caught in a corrupt system. We're caught in a corrupt system. That is the reality. So whatever story that we tackle, invariably, there's going to be a level of corruption attached to it because, you know, that's just the way it is. You know, the McCann case, the Epstein case, whether we talk about cancer, whether we talk about vaccines, the level of, you know, government involvement, of political involvement, you know, I think, Sean, if you and I set out to try and uncover everything that was corrupt about this country, we'd need several lifetimes to be able to do it.
We'd end up in the Clinton body count.
We really would. And one thing I want to just say before I go about Epstein, please, everybody, look out for Jonathan King. Do you remember Jonathan King? Jonathan King became very famous, I think, in the 60s and 70s. He wrote Johnny Reggae. Do you remember that song? Johnny Reggae, Reggae. It was a very famous song in the 70s. But Jonathan King was the hit maker. He was very, very famous Radio 1 DJ or DJ. Jonathan King, I have been watching for a while. He's a paedophile. He was done for grooming young boys. And over the last week, I've noticed that he started to say certain things about Epstein, right, publicly on his Twitter feed and stuff, like basically dispel the women there, you know, they're sort of whores, that kind of attitude and everything. But what I'd like to say to everybody about Jonathan King is Jonathan King is somebody who should most definitely be watched. And Jonathan King links to Simon Cowell, because when Jonathan King was first arrested on paedophile charges, it was Simon Cowell who has corrupted Saturday Night TV by putting imagery on X Factor and Britain's Got Talent, which is completely inappropriate for family viewing. But it was Simon Cowell who put up £50,000 for Jonathan King, right? So, and I have been told that Simon Cowell has a link to Epstein. And so that's why I bring in Jonathan King, because I'm wondering if that's the link.
Well, we've got the Max Clifford link, haven't we, as well, with Cowell, big time.
Right.
Yeah.
Simon Cowell is another puppet master. He's another puppet master. The imagery that he has allowed on Saturday Night TV is obscene. He has sexualized children for the last generation. That has happened. And there are some very dodgy pictures of Simon Cowell where he's in Thailand with children. Yeah, I'm not making any allegations here. I'm just saying that there are pictures online that people might want to have a look at that are freely available. And the fact that he would put up 50K for Jonathan King, who anybody who knew anything in the industry knew that Jonathan King was a wrong un. And Simon Cowell said, I didn't know.
Someone just sent me a picture this morning of Epstein and Prince Andrew in Thailand with topless Asian girls.
Right.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I'm going to encourage everybody to go down into the description box and please support Sonia. Watch the documentaries. Share them, comment on them, please subscribe to her channel. All her work is down there. She's been very generous with her time. She's come on the podcast twice now in quite a short period of time. I know you guys are all going to be demanding that we try and get her back on in 2020. So we'll see what develops and what else there is to talk about, but I would personally love to have her back on. She really resonates with the audience. Is there anything you would like to say to the people watching
Not
your
really.
Videos?
Carry on. Feel free to carry on contacting me. I would prefer, actually, if you would contact me by email, sonyapolton@sky.com, just because telephone calls are so difficult. Some people have recorded me, not people who have come through you, but I have been recorded in the past. People have just put me online without my permission. So I'm always a bit like, when people I don't know ring me, I'm a bit like, oh, who are they? What are they coming at me with? So generally, if you want to make contact with me, it is better to contact me by email. But I would just like to really just say, Sean, you know, big up yourself, more power to your elbow. What you're doing actually is brilliant, because you are actually making really incredibly difficult subjects quite popularist. And that's a really good thing to do, because we need things to be popularist in order for the mass majority to get it. So I think what you're doing is a fantastic thing. Love chatting with you. It's been great. Great here with the guys, so thank you for having me.
And I'd like to thank all of the YouTube viewers and subscribers who are helping steer the channel. It's you guys sending me the links to Sonia's stuff and to other people's stuff that have caused these interviews to happen. So please keep sending me your ideas. The True Crime Podcast started out with us interviewing people who just had prison experiences. It went over to ex-cops, ex-guards, journalists. It's forever expanding, and we want to keep it that way. Huge thank you also to the people who have sent in donations, PayPal, Patreon, Just Giving, to enable us to produce high quality videos like this in a proper recording studio with a sound engineer and a cameraman present. So all those links, if you want to support the channel, are down there in the description box as well. And if you've not subscribed yet, if you're enjoying these, it's free to subscribe. Subscription logo is in the bottom right hand corner. And have a great 2020 out there, and we look forward to producing more excellent content. Do you remember the Arizona prison handshake?
No, but I'm sure you're going to teach it
okay,
to
so
me.
It's, oh
my
it's
god!
That, and then that,
yeah,
and then bump fist.
there you go.
Cheers! Thank you, everyone.
Be a crim.
Well done. Give me a hug as well.
Yeah.